2020 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in our virtual meeting this morning. In the spirit of social distancing due to the COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by phone and by Skype. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to make comment and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will be opening up phone lines for such comments and public comment in this afternoon's business session. This morning, this meeting is a study session. As I mentioned, the business session will be this afternoon starting at 1 o'clock. Today, we have all five commissioners on the phone: General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, are all in the boardroom. At this time, we have a Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute, and I understand Tracy Yaunt is going to be leading us in this.
Yes, this is Tracy, Interim Director of Safety in HPI. So we'll get started with the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag,
of the United States. To the Republic
for which it stands, one nation, under God,
indivisible,
with liberty and justice for all.
All right. So today I'm here with my Interim Director of Safety and HPI hat on to talk about a couple of stories where the HPI mindset is helping to put some defenses in place to protect our employees. A little bit of background. Last week, we had 4 of 5 employees in a Rocky Reach work crew test positive for COVID-19. And as a result, we had several folks reach out to me with their concerns and ideas. They revolved around communications, the proactive measures we take, the reactive measures we take, work practices, and a really important idea that some folks out at Rocky Reach shared, that if you're thinking about COVID, you may not be thinking about other important aspects of your task. Things on their mind right now include cross-contamination, crew co-mingling, cleaning, and work prioritization. So the first story I'd like to share is how a couple of employees created job-specific COVID-19 protocol. Jim McDonald and Bing White came up with the goals. Their first one was maintain employee diligence, and the second was to keep the project going. The additional defenses they put in place were really great. They defined physical boundaries and made specific employees responsible for each of those boundaries, those work boundaries. They limit access in and out of those areas. Sharing information between boundaries requires communication with the boundary owner. They use Bluetooth wireless headset technology, which they apparently really like. They do daily cleaning before and after using tools, surfaces, equipment. They log co-worker contact for longer than 15 minutes. And this last one that I'd like to mention is really great. They do daily pre-task plan reminders, and they use that time also to talk about further process improvements. They know they are still learning, as we all are. The second story is about employee engagement. We had 2 employees, Todd Melton and Bing White, again. They had concerns and were thinking about solutions they wanted to discuss. We met outside under the trees at Rocky Reach, and they shared a lot of great information. They have ideas about how to improve work crew isolation practices, enhanced cleaning practices, and several more. They followed up with an email with some great information and thoughts. What this has led to is some immediate actions, for example, stepping up some cleaning protocols. It also led to a couple of leadership meetings at Rocky Reach and Rock Island this week to discuss changes and gather additional ideas. It also led to establishing site-specific task force to get more ideas on an ongoing basis, and the hope is to include employees and leadership in those task forces. So these are just 2 great examples of employees figuring out and being the solution. And I just want to commend all of them, and there's many more, but these are two specific examples that I wanted to share about HPI and this COVID deal we're dealing with. Any questions or comments?
Tracy, those are great observations and great comments, and it points to the quality of the folks here and the staff at Chelan PUD, and everyone is wanting to help and do the very best job they can. So thank you for sharing that.
You bet.
Okay, well, commissioners, thank you, Tracy. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
If there are no more questions for Tracy, we can move on to the approval of the agenda. Any item on the consent agenda shall be subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such request? Was there some comment? I heard someone speaking. Hearing no request to move to the consent agenda, Steve, I think we're ready to move on.
Okay. We'd like to move to study session agenda item 3. This is the customer satisfaction survey results. I'm going to turn this over to John Stoll, and he also has a visitor that is joining us today.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director, Customer Utilities. A little bit late this year with COVID, but we did complete the survey partnership with Communications. And for this year, we used Strategies 360. My opinion, I think they did a very thorough job. And with us today, we have Alex Dunn to go through those results. And I will jump in from time to time as well.
Yeah. Hey, Commissioners. Nice to be with you today. My name is Alex Dunn. I work with Strategies 360. We're based in Seattle, and we conduct public opinion research on behalf of a kind of wide array of organizations, including a lot of PUDs in Washington State and in other states. So it was really a pleasure for us to work with Chelan PUD in this project. On the next slide, I just want to say a couple things about how we conducted this. So what we did is at the end of June and early July, we surveyed just over 500 residential customers drawn from the PUD's own customer lists, and we reached them via cell phone, landline, and also a combination of email solicitations, allowing some folks to take it online as well. And I believe that this is the first time that the PUD has conducted an online component. Generally, we recommend that because it ensures that the representativeness of the community is better, which makes the accuracy better and really gives everyone a chance to participate. The overall margin of error for the survey is plus or minus 4.3%. Of course, that's higher for subgroup analyses. And this is statistically representative of the county based on U.S. Census estimates. So everything from gender and age to race and region, including just about 70% Caucasian, 27% Hispanic, and also we just mentioned that because oftentimes that is a difficulty in reaching minority groups and also younger citizens of the county based on, dwindling landline contact rates. So we felt really good about how this survey turned out and our ability to reach everyone. On the next slide, and I'll go through these fairly quickly just to keep us moving. I know you have a lot to cover today, but this shows you the overall satisfaction with Chelan PUD on a scale from 1 to 5, where 1 is very dissatisfied and 5 is very satisfied. So 63%, almost two-thirds of the county reporting the maximum possible satisfaction score. And when you include 4s and 5s, that number jumps to nearly 90%. So this is a group of customers who's telling you that things are going really well for them right now in their relationship with the PUD. And similarly and equally importantly, very few on the negative side. Those ones and twos number just 5% combined. On the next slide, you can see a real quick breakdown by demographic. I know that in the past you've had, and this is our first time working with the PUD on this project, and you've had previous survey vendors in the past that there have been some questions about how this shakes out by demographic groups. I do want to tell you that there is a correlation with age and length of tenure in the county. This is fairly intuitive. Our younger folks in Chelan County who haven't had as much of a chance to build a durable relationship with a PUD yet show a little bit less intensity behind their satisfaction ratings, but very similar overall satisfaction ratings. And then on the other side of the coin, you have your Latino and Hispanic residents that are really giving you exceptional scores. 74% say that they are very satisfied. Caucasian residents also quite satisfied overall, but those outreach and connection with the Latino community in particular has really made some strides there. Very little difference by educational attainment. I'm happy to answer any additional questions on the demographic breakouts, but want to keep things moving for the time being. So on the next slide, you can see how your overall satisfaction looks in 2020 compared to how it looked in the last three customer satisfaction surveys over the last six or so years. So you will notice that scores are down a little bit. The fives in particular have shifted to 63%, which is down a little over 10 points. Although, what I want to point out, sorry, was there a question?
No, I didn't hear one. Keep going, Alex.
Great. I do want to point out that it appears that most of the shift here has occurred from the folks who are very satisfied, moving into kind of the middle. So if you look at those three scores and the not sure scores, those have increased a little bit. The ones and twos have increased a bit as well, but still very low. So overall satisfaction, as you can see in the mean scores on the right side, has stayed pretty consistent with a little bit of a dip. We can't tell you exactly what is behind this, but it's reasonable to say that with COVID-19 and the financial relationship that customers have with you, economic circumstances they've been facing the last few months and difficulties at work and saving, we see these sorts of impacts for a lot of other types of organizations as well. And this is just a really unique time. Of course, there could be other things underlying this, and that might be something to check in on in 2 years when you conduct your next survey. But overall, things are looking pretty stable. On the next slide, you can see the breakdown into, so basically we asked a follow-up question to satisfaction, which allowed them in their own words to tell us why they gave you that score. And I just want to kick it over to John Stoll, who has done a quick analysis of how these comments break down.
Thanks, Alex. One of the big benefits for us at the utility is to go through those comments. As you can see, the positives are very strong. It's really encouraging to read through those positive comments. A lot of the neutral comments were basically, I haven't lived here long enough. I've never really dealt with the PUD, so they just remain neutral. And then, of course, there's the folks who had a more of a negative perspective. So I always like to take the opportunity to go through each and every one of those comments and categorize them. All total, I think there was around 500 specific comments, which makes sense given the survey size. And then going down, or what were the, more on the negative ratings, what led the charge? Rates, it was clear. And to give you a perspective, that 5% was 23 comments around rates. Again, I think we've had some rate discussions. There was the rate action was deferred, but nevertheless, it was still out there and on people's minds. From there, it drops off pretty quickly. Policies and reliability, they're down to about 12 comments apiece. And then you can just see as it goes down the line, of course, people wanting fiber. Our bill pay, there's a few comments around wanting that to improve. So, again, these are very helpful because as we look at our business plans and we look at the things that we're doing, this certainly helps guide us and give us some feedback. So That's one piece of it. Another piece is at the very end of the survey, I believe it was just an open-ended question, is there anything else you would like to tell the PUD? For that question, we had about 100 comments. A lot of people just said, no, nothing more to add. But of those 100 comments, they were a little more wide-ranging. A lot of them were very positive, appreciative of the service, the rates. But then again, there's always opportunities to hear from our customers. So we went through those and actually assigned them to each managing director to look into what those comments were. And that's a process we're currently reviewing as we speak. An example would be, I'd like to see this type of a conservation program. Or one comment was, I can't believe meter readers come out and read our meters. And then another comment, I'm not a fan of the smart meter approach. So, again, but we have those, and each managing director will be looking at those comments, and we'll most likely in the future come back with how that shook out. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, John. So on the next slide, we've got another breakdown for you on how those positive comments shook out. So just folks who were generally satisfied that said things like, you know, keep up the good work in the community, it's good to see you guys out there. That took up the lion's share of these comments. Also, quite a bit of applause on good rates, consistent, reliable service, and quick responses to outages and problems like that, and linemen just being really out there and you know, short wait times when things do go down, good customer service, and then a smattering of other responses. On the next slide, you can see that we also probed on some of the specific dimensions of satisfaction. So we started by asking overall satisfaction, then we asked them on the issue of reliability and on quality of communication, how would you rate your satisfaction on a scale from 1 to 5. You'll notice that these specific components of satisfaction score even higher than overall satisfaction. So when it comes to reliability, and we also saw this, as I mentioned in the comments, folks feeling really happy with the reliability of their service and the quality of their communication. On the next slide, there are a few more. So this is basically just the breakdown on those two metrics over time. Quality of communication has only been asked in your survey since 2018. That's stayed remarkably stable. Since 2014, those surveys have included this reliability question, and that is down a little bit in tracking with overall satisfaction, but still almost 8 in 10 scoring you very satisfied. So those are the folks who are just giving you fives on reliability. On the next slide, you can see a few more dimensions that we looked into here. So these are how well the PUD communicates with customers on a few different things. First of all, offering ways to manage their accounts, 59% excellent. When you take fours and fives together, you're at just about 8 in 10 who are giving you strong scores on options for managing their accounts. There are some folks here who just aren't sure or give you a score in the middle, that kind of neutral 3 score, very few falling into the ones and twos. Providing ways to save, almost, you know, really similar scores to the ways to manage your account. And then outages and PUD finances, still overwhelmingly positive, but more neutral and not sure responses in there from folks who just don't feel like they know enough to really rate the PUD on those aspects. On the next slide, there are a few more metrics here. So we asked whether respondents agreed or disagreed with the following statements about the PUD, that they are a utility you can trust, a good corporate citizen, a good environmental steward, and well-managed. And across the board, you're seeing the same trends here. Really strong sense of trust in the utility. That is the aspect that really predominated for folks. And then strong scores on the others as well. And I just want to note that on this slide and the last slide, these various dimensions that we've checked in on, we do have the ability to look back at past scores on those, and they are all essentially within the margin of error compared to where they were at in 2018. So those mean scores that you see on the right may have differed by 0.05 or 0.1, but very little difference there. So in terms of your standing in the community and feeling like you're a part of the community, those scores are high and stable.
Can I just ask a question?
Yep.
That's on the well-managed, on the score of 56, under strongly agree, and 12, not sure. So if I'm understanding correctly, you're saying that's been consistent since 2018?
Yeah, there's almost no change, no measurable change. It's any difference there is within the margin of error.
So in terms of questions, is there anything that we can call from the responses that might help us to improve that score?
So, you know, I guess what I would refer you to are some of the neutral or negative comments, and I know John can speak to these as well. You know, there were a couple questions about, and you'll actually see this on the next slide, there's, we checked in on communication, you know, ways in which the PUD can communicate with residents and whether they're aware of them and what they would like to see in terms of additional communication options. So maybe we can actually just jump to that slide because I think it speaks to your question. Actually go one more ahead.
Okay.
So there are, there's quite a bit of appetite here for some of these additional customer resources. Online bill payment, text, email, and voicemail alerts. I know that some of this is part of your existing portfolio of communications assets, but charts and dashboards showing energy data, you can just see that all five of these options have at least half, if not more, of folks saying, yeah, that's a resource that I would use. It would give me more information than I currently have, and it also might make them feel a little bit more connected to the goings-on of the PUD and able to provide better ratings on things like well-managed, where, you know, you just have a quarter of folks who just don't know, you know. So I think that's probably one thing I would point you towards, as well as just engaging with the younger folks and the folks who haven't been in the county as long that just don't know quite as much about, you know, how things have been going with the PUD, what that relationship looks like, and don't know the track record that the PUD has in the community. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you.
Sure. I don't want to totally skip over the prior slide, so Rebecca, if you wouldn't mind just going back there real quickly. Perfect. So this was the last slide with metrics. This is perceptions about customer service. A few different dimensions here that the PUD treats me as a customer as an individual and with respect, that they are responsive to customer needs, and that they are experienced, knowledgeable, and proactive. These are questions, again, that the PUD has been asking at least since 2018, but always want to get a sense of whether there are meaningful shifts, and we're happy to report that, once again, these are really consistent and really consistently positive. And this also dovetails with a lot of the responses where folks would call out, you know, folks on the phone lines or in the offices or the linemen as folks that they thought they could count on and would get good information from. I believe that's all we have for you. If you want to go ahead two slides, Rebecca, I think that's the last one. Yeah, so we do have some more information for your own review on your own time just about how we conducted this and how these things break down in more detail. But happy to answer any questions that you have.
Commissioner Smith, and I'm just curious, looking at this, this is a good-looking, the report. I wonder if we have tracked the history of the shift we made, especially this go-around, with how we sourced our information, our sample, you know, the number of cell phones versus landlines, and various methods of people responding. How big a shift was that this go around from previous surveys?
Yeah, that's a great question, Commissioner. And I can't speak to all of the specifics about how your prior survey firm conducted their research, but I can tell you that this is the largest sample size that the PUD has conducted. So typically it was looking at 400 respondents, and we were able to get a little over almost 525 We also added the online component. And in terms of hewing really closely to what the demographic profile of your community looks like per the census, I think this is the closest that any surveys have come in terms of including an adequate number of younger folks, Latinos, and so we feel like it was a really comprehensive sampling method, and in turn, that should increase the accuracy and decrease the margin of error.
Yeah, I just wondered when every time you say we increase the participation of the younger group, that's a really good thing in my eyes, and I just wonder if potentially in the past we've been missing some of that, and this may be even a more accurate reflection than we've seen in the past, even though it's down just a little bit.
Yeah, the last thing I can say to that is that, you know, the reason why I called out the younger folks and the Hispanic community in particular is just because they are almost completely unreachable by landline now. And so we really have to rely heavily on cell phones and wherever we can online sampling. And so what we did is we, of the phones that we sampled, almost, I think about three quarters were cell phones, about a quarter landline, and then the rest online. And so that really did, you know, we all always do well in contacting older folks and folks in, you know, different aspects of the community, especially more educated folks. They're never a problem for us. And so it's not that we sampled them any less, but we just were able to really get a more, a fuller kind of more representative snapshot, I think. So again, I'm happy to answer questions after about that, but I think you guys should feel really good that you're getting the voices kind of from across the community in the survey here.
Commissioners, this is Steve. I'd like to add a couple of things from the demographic data that's in the appendix. If you go to that, you'll see on the first page of the appendix that in particular, note that that younger category, 18 to 34, is an opportunity area for us where we are not getting as high of a very satisfied score. Don't have as much experience with us, presumably, but there is an opportunity area there. And certainly some of the efforts that we have with moving to more mobile applications, I think, will help us with that, that community. Second thing. If you turn over, there was a much greater emphasis on trying to make sure that we got to the Hispanic community, and you'll note that actually in the Hispanic community, I think we would have, at least I would have thought, that maybe that was an area that we could do better in, and actually it turns out that our score there is higher than average within that community. Commissioner Smith had asked the question the last time around 2 years ago with respect to what about that community that has a high school degree or less, and we weren't sure how well we were doing in terms of sampling that group. You can see here we've got that broken out and identified that, first of all, we think we have gotten to that group this time around, and they're pretty much our average, you know, of terms of being very satisfied. And then final point I would make is that on the next page, that if you haven't lived here for very long, your level of satisfaction isn't as high as people who've lived here longer. I think that is a good sign. The longer you've lived here, the more you know about Chelan PUD, the more likely you are to be in the very satisfied category. So just point those out as some of the areas that we'll be thinking about as we try to take advantage of the survey data to look towards how do we show improvement. Any other questions from commissioners?
I just thought it was interesting. The more your bill is, the less satisfied you are. I think that that's pretty normal.
That is normal.
But I do think that challenge of looking at how to reach a new generation of ratepayers is a good challenge for us. So look forward to hearing ideas on that. I think that's pretty standard in lots of different areas too. So
okay, if there are no other questions, we will say thanks to Alex and appreciate your presentation and move on to the next item.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Okay, next up is our quarterly district performance plan update, and everyone is familiar with the fact that we do this by exception. So we will be starting from page one as normal with the fiber activities with one adjustment. This is our first meeting after Mike Coleman's retirement, and so Bob Shane will be standing in for him. And I should also mention that Kelly Boyd is on leave today, and Mark Mullins will be standing in for her. So, Bob, you're up.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, Commissioners. As Steve mentioned, Bob Shane, Interim Managing Director of the Fiber at Telecom. Under Objective 1A, fiber expansion, COVID-19 has definitely played a role in delaying our construction activities related to the Q2 fiber expansions for primarily the areas of Eagle Creek and the Leavenworth area and Steinhill for the Cashmere-Dryden area. We are anticipating to complete both areas sometime in late Q3 to early Q4, and we expect to achieve those numbers out of those two areas. Under Objective 1B, installation service interval, we have two major contributing factors. One is adjusting to the pole attachment program that we've mentioned before, and also the initial COVID-19 construction impact. We will continue to fine-tune and streamline the process where possible to drive those intervals down. Once again, we're going to try to overcome the impacts of COVID-19 the best that we can. Any questions there?
Thanks, Bob. Next up is mine, and this is getting our activities in place to allow our business plans to be ready on time, establishing five-year priorities and metrics. We did complete that. It was just after the deadline. It was impacted by COVID-19 activities, and just to give the board comfort, we are on schedule for producing budgets under the regular schedule that you become accustomed to.
Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. I've got the next couple of items that are in regard to the administration of the Annual Public Power Benefit Program. And we did provide you an update on June 1st. And look forward to talking with you a little bit later this year as we talk about solicitation for 2021 projects, probably in the September timeframe. Thank you.
Bob, you are next up.
I'm sorry, I had it on mute there. So we have the acceleration evaluation coming up later on this morning, so we have completed that assignment just after the deadline.
Good morning. This is Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. I've got on the second page here, item 1G2, Rocky Reach Discovery Center improvements. We had a plan to begin construction of the Discovery Center by June 30th this year. That was an interim milestone. We had to put that on hold a little bit just to rework some of the overall facilities out at Rocky Reach. We are in the process of opening bids as we speak and expect to mobilize for construction in September, and we still expect to have the new Discovery Center completed May, June timeframe next year.
This is John. I've got the next one. That's on the survey. Just heard the readout, but obviously we did not hit the initial time frame that is now complete. I have the next one as well, and that's on our annual engineering operational workshop we put together with our stakeholders. That has been delayed until fall due to COVID.
I've got the next one, Commissioners, on adopt a long-term management plan for Aranda River Park. Given the consolidation of the port districts, and they have requested additional time to review the current structure as well as the operation and maintenance agreement that we have in place. And so they have asked to defer the long-term management plan until 2021. And we've reviewed and concurred with that request.
Good morning, Commissioners. This is Andrew Christel filling in for Greg Carrington. I'm on page 3, looking at items number 2F1 and 2F, or 2F2 and 2F3. 2F2 is expand strategic energy management to the agricultural industry. SEM is when we go into the facility and work with operators, engineers, et cetera, to identify low-cost items as well as impactful capital projects. We were very successful working with Confluence Health in the past year. And so 2020, we wanted to line up the agricultural industry. And we have lined up almost one average megawatt of SCM projects already in different phases for this year. I'll have more information to you on this particular program in the near future. And then the 2F3 is the redesign SNAP program to be on par with the business case for energy efficiency projects. We provided the board with a recent update on this redesign. A rebate program has been redesigned. We're also working on a low-income program. And now we're really, the devils are in the details. We're digging in and working on what needs to be done for implementation of that program. And so that'll be the next step of this project, which is scheduled for 12-1.
We're now towards the bottom of page 4. Got item 2I4. This is B7. We were expecting to, this is one of the units we were expecting to return to service this year. There have been some delays on the new bushings associated with B7, so the revised estimated return to service date has moved to first quarter of 2021. Next item is 2J. This is our Powerhouse 2 modernization effort. We had a goal to have a full evaluation of long-term warranty and oilless hubs by September 30th. That timeline is longer than anticipated due to the importance of the issues as well as the learning curve on the design build process, and we're looking at more towards fourth quarter for the extended warranty decision. Next item is 2K. We had a goal to submit the Rock Island hydroseismic project plan to FERC by June 30th, and that was completed on June 29th. And then top of page 5, we have objective 2L, Rock Island spillway modernization business case complete by year end. I colored that one yellow. We're still on track, but we've certainly used up any float we had in the schedule as the interim milestones are behind, so we're going to keep a close eye on that one.
Commissioners, I have the next one. That's under the asset management customer utilities of identifying those critical assets that meet the criteria. That is coded red. We have done quite a bit of work, but we just haven't gotten to the point of putting it all together through some quality assurance review.
Commissioners, I've got all three items on page 6. The first one is gain value for hydropower by educating House and Senate leadership. And so we had certainly an effective outreach effort early on in the session. And then, of course, the focus turned to COVID. So that is why that is red. Next, down midway and down on the page, work with City of Wenatchee to develop stormwater outfall master plan for the Horan area. The city's current construction schedule, which would provide for stormwater treatment of the stormwater before it gets into the Horan area, scheduled for 2021. And so that is read accordingly. Lastly, at the bottom of the page, define the Rock Island Relicensing Strategy for Endangered Species Act and Habitat Conservation Plan compliance. We envisioned a lot of one-on-one and small group meetings with stakeholders and regulatory agencies as we devised the strategy. Those efforts have been put on hold because of COVID, and that is why that is read. Thank you. All right, and then I've got three items on page 7 as well. First one, 3A, site development notice to proceed for the District Service Center. We'll be discussing that a little bit later this morning on your agenda. So pleased to report that as green. Next up, define aesthetics for service center. Our service center design process is ongoing. It's certainly shifted a bit with COVID-19 and our ability to meet with review committee, but those efforts are now being done electronically. And of course, you've participated in some of those events recently as well. So that is read because of the delay, but it will not delay the overall timing for the service center project. Further down, finalize the redevelopment plan of the Fifth Street campus. As you might imagine, for similar reasons, that process has been slowed with COVID. We've done presentation to the board. We've worked closely with the participants of the planning process, but that effort is on hold until the capacity and the market conditions change. The next step is to do final presentations before the court and the city, and those have not been scheduled yet, but we do anticipate that those will be scheduled towards the latter part of this year.
Commissioners, this is John again. I'm on page 8. This is all under a fire risk management strategy. We have a number of action items. We had some pretty aggressive first quarter plans, which obviously we deferred due to COVID. The first one was recruiting and hiring another forester. We did complete that, although after the date. The next one is to look at a vegetation management process. Again, we continue to work, but we had hoped to have one picked by the end of June. That has not happened. And then number 4, pick the appropriate vegetation standard. We did. We selected the urban wildlife plan standard, and you will hear more about this at the next board meeting. Next page, continuing with me, we had a goal under our substation efforts to receive and deploy 2 new mobile substations. They were delayed due to COVID, but we anticipate receiving those in Q3. The next one is complete the initial site design of the Wenatchee substation. That's the one down there just south of Pybus. That has been completed.
Next one is Objective 2X. This has to do with our capital plans, and we actually moved this one from red to yellow from compared to last quarter. We're at 78.3% of our capital budget spend at this point during the year with a goal of 80%. So we're just under, and that is mainly due to the delays at Powerhouse 1.
Commissioners, I've got 2 items on page 11. A3, evaluate alternatives to WDFW, hatchery operation monitoring and evaluation. We had a target of the end of June to have that work completed. We were delayed approximately 1 month, and so are just in the final stages of review, and I look forward to presenting our results to you soon. And on the very bottom of the page, E1, complete requirements for the Chelan River use attainability analysis. The schedule has shifted a little bit in terms of ecology's timing. Because of COVID-19, they are behind about 60 days. but we are certainly committed to seeing that project through and are in constant consultation and discussion with them, and believe that the 60-day delay is hopefully the maximum extent of the delay. I've got one on page 12 as well, G1. This is in reference to the execution of our plan to conduct the HCP survival studies at Rock Island and Rocky Reach, beginning with Rock Island in 2021. So we undertook an RFP process and are evaluating those submissions right now. And you'll hear a little bit more about where we're at in this process at the Fish and Wildlife update momentarily.
Got commissioners, page 14. I've got 3A. Finalized model to assess the impact of new loads on district's financial position. This shifted to some lower priority work within EP&T. There's also been some staffing changes that have impacted this project, and so it is behind schedule at this time. I'd like to go to 3E, develop strategies to provide hydro, wind, solar products for new customers and investigate options. So right now we are, phase one of this is complete. The team has developed three different potential product descriptions for package of resources, combinations, and right now they're working with a consultant to develop that pricing for those 3C, which should be moving forward.
And I've got the next one, and that is our efforts to develop joint principles with BPA regarding the new Canadian Entitlement Allocation Agreement. We have made practically no progress there, not for lack of effort. We have put proposed principles on the table. We have not been able to get a meaningful engagement with Bonneville on that. We think probably as a result of direction coming from the State Department. So we continue to reach out and ask when is the time. Most recent we've heard is that it would be later this year sometime.
I have the next one, J2B, develop joint principles with BPA regarding the PNCA replacement contract. COVID-19 has slowed the hiring process that was needed for the resources to implement this project, missed the date of 7/1/2020. So this one is behind schedule. I'll go to number 3A, stabilize operations so that reservoir buffers can be removed. Again, the additional resources that we identified to move this project forward, we do not have those quite yet. And so due to COVID-19, that hiring process has been slowed down as well.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mark Mullins, Director, Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics, filling in for Kelly Boyd. I have the next two items, which is Objective 4L, receive clean audit opinion and no material deficiencies. I'm happy to report that we did accomplish that goal, and we did so by our deadline of April 30th, 2020. The next item is Item N2 specifically, the debt portfolio optimization with the board's support. By the end of Q1 to move forward with debt action plans. Those plans were accomplished by the end of Q2, meeting that deadline. More specifically, we executed on that plan in May.
Next item is the top of page 16. This is our actual operating expenses on the hydro system with a goal between 90 and 105% year to date. We're running at 82.4% at the end of the second quarter. Main driver here is the deferral of a budgeted project in C-10 and C-11 long-term repairs at Rocky Reach. We did that in order to prioritize the trunnion bushing replacements on units C-1 through 7.
I have the one right underneath when looking at distribution in that same range. We're just right outside the floor of that at 90% of 89.2.
Next item is top of page 17. We had the goal to have the rate and rate methodology for the transmission rates presented to the board for approval by the end of June. We just missed that with approval on July 6th. So that one is completed shortly after the goal deadline there. Next item is the interconnection processes. We had planned to have completed by the end of June as well. That one has taken a hit due to COVID-19 and reprioritizing resources that were going to be working on that. We are still planning to complete this item in 2020.
The following one on the board policy options to consider assessing a proportional share of infrastructure costs. We had a June 30th goal to present that. You will hear more later this morning, and we continue on with that effort. Next one I have is underachieving CIS stability with the C2M system. That is coded red. We had originally anticipated probably about a three-month stability time frame. The project was pushed out a little bit, plus we're understanding more about the system and the demands. There's a significant amount of work that will just be ongoing for the foreseeable future to work towards stabilizing the system and working to that end.
Next up is we have been evaluating participation in what's called GridX. This is a national exercise looking primarily at cybersecurity issues. The decision is with respect to participation in the 2021 process. We actually have had a very spirited discussion about this in terms of priorities, and likely we'll be bringing this to conclusion in the next week, but we did not hit our June 30th deadline.
Next item is objective 5-0. This one had a goal of June 30th for compliance with the SIP 13 standard, which was originally planned to go into effect on July 1. Since then, the regulators have extended that in effect date 3 months to October 1. So even though this one's red, happy to report that we're well ahead of the new timeline, and we began soft implementation on July 17th.
Hi, this is Tracy with Safety and HPI on page 19, item 6A2, senior team safety visits. We didn't meet our target here, largely because of the remote work and not being in the office as much. I also have the second item. Can you scroll just a little bit? There we go, thank you. Recommendations given as a result of safety events within 45 days. We changed the metric on this to now reflect that we're done, safety and HPI is done, when we provide that recommendation to the group who's going to be responsible for implementing. So we have made a 100% red to green transition on that one.
And this is Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources. On the top of page 20, under the recruiting metric, we have colored the 6-1 yellow for caution because most of our hiring managers have wanted to conduct in-person interviews before making a hire decision, and in-person interviews were on hold for several weeks. Also, counterintuitively, we have been finding that people may be hunkering down and we are receiving fewer job applications, and have also found that some candidates who had previously applied are pulling out of processes because they're uncomfortable about either relocating at this time or just changing employers. So that's that one. Then the next one that we have also turned to yellow is F1, and that one is implementing at least three strategies intended to increase district employment of women and minorities. We've changed that to yellow because not just leaders in human resources, but also in the other business units that we were going to be partnering with to identify strategies have been consumed by the COVID-19 response and have really not been able to meet to develop goals and strategies.
Okay, now down on page 21, 6G, to execute on established milestones for 2020 for HPI, that has moved to, from green to red, largely because the training that we have had planned, which was face-to-face, is being retooled, so that has not happened yet. And then the other 6G, H is the implementation plan to address the recommendations from the 21 linked concerns found during the survey from the investigation, and that was presented to the board on the 15th, and all items have been transferred to business units for continued follow-up. So that is now blue.
Good morning, Commissioners. Eric Walquist, General Counsel. I have the top of page 22, the governance, risk, and compliance metrics, objective 7A1 and 2, had June 30 completion dates. Those were not met. We are continuing to make progress on those efforts, but they have been delayed. We actually have a meeting tomorrow afternoon. To follow up on items 1 and 2, item 3 was evaluate the expansion of the GRC modules into health and safety. That also carried an end of Q2 completion date, but with COVID-19, that was not met. That relates to, A4, which is develop a plan by the end of the year for safety. At this point, you could debate whether or not that one for Q2 should be yellow or red. We have changed it to red for the time being because we don't really see a way to complete the acceleration of that effort for safety and health and have that complete by the end of the year. We are hopeful, but with COVID and the continuous changes there, it's very unlikely that we'll be able to complete that effort by year's end. So we hope to continue and complete items A1 and A2. It is likely that 3 and 4 will slip into next year.
Commissioners, have the next one on the AMI, the Automated Metering System Purchase and Implementation Contract. We had planned to present that to you by the end of June. That did not happen. Certainly a lot of the subject matter experts are working on CIS stabilization and other efforts, but we do have that on our radar to bring back to you later this year.
This is Bob Shane, so I'm going to talk about Objective 7.3 A and B. We're taking our time and care to make sure we evaluate all of the many automation options that are available under the portal. We're looking at both technical or looking at technical operational business opportunities to really look at the best solutions set forth. To help keep us moving, we are identifying those areas that we can postpone and evaluate at a later date to keep it all moving. Overall, we still believe we'll have a system in place and running by the end of the year.
The next one is item 5B, implement Azure Information Protection. The data protection capabilities, our intent was to have that rolled out by Q2. The Azure Information Protection is added functionality for document protection and classification as also as a precursor for Office 365 and Microsoft Teams. We did miss the Q2 deadline, but we did do quite a bit of outreach internally among the IT group to get some feedback before we roll this out on a district-wide level. We are going to call this complete in Q3. You may have received some training notifications already, but we are advancing this effort, and we should call it blue at the end of the next reporting period.
Hi, Commissioners. Item C5 at the very bottom. This is tied to the physical battery installation. If a decision is made to move forward with this, the installation will not occur in 2020. It's been pushed back due to all of the other pushbacks and schedules. This was provided to the board, I think it was a couple weeks ago, an updated schedule on that. And so we're looking at
So that brings us to the conclusion. You can see that we're tracking about 218 items. A little more than half are on track, which is pretty substantially below what we would normally have at this time of year. We are actually coding those that are clearly COVID-19 delays. Without those, we'd probably be at about 80%. 80% is probably about normal for where we'd be at this time of year. So there's a pretty clear connection between what's going on with COVID and our ability to complete performance plan items. With that, we're open to any questions that the board may have.
Commissioners, any questions? Steve, this is Gary. I guess I have a question, and that is, in the event that we have a prolonged COVID impact on our work moving forward, do you see it having an accelerated decline in terms of being able to achieve future projects and moving forward with our strategic goal plans?
I think the key item at this point is, do we have enough spike in infection where we have to retreat in terms of our operating strategies to go back to where we were in March? If we had to particularly take our remote workforce and or for those that cannot work remotely and we needed to do something with them, that would have a really significant impact. A lot of the other work here where we've got people working remotely, I think we've figured that out, and I think we're feeling pretty good that we can accomplish that work. So I'd say there's a segment of this which continues to be at risk depending on the level of infection in the community and particularly the number of employees who come down. We, 3 weeks ago, had zero employees who were confirmed positive, and today we're at six. So we've certainly seen the increase in infection in the community beginning to seep into our workforce, and that is concerning as to what the potential implications could be for being able to accomplish the performance plan. So like a lot of things, there's just this big pincer movement around us of the level of infection of COVID-19 that will impact our ability to be able to implement the performance plan.
Thank you. Commissioners, any other questions for the team?
Not for me.
Okay, Steve, I guess we're ready to move on.
Okay, next up is the quarterly financial review and investment report. Mark Mullins will be doing this presentation today.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning again, commissioners. This is Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And today we'll do the quarterly financial review for quarter ended June 30, 2020. So this presentation does support a number of resolutions that require quarterly reporting to the board on compliance with our long-range financial policies, business line financial policies, and our investment policy, as well as the board's balanced scorecard objective of maintaining strong financial stewardship. Moving to page two, we'll go through this material relatively quickly. The content and the format is the same, and you'll find that our Q2 results are similar to Q1. We'll walk through our financial highlights, report on our Q2 results, we'll look at our five-year forecast, a quick peek at our investment report, and leave you with some key messages. There is additional information in the back of your package. No action required today. This is an update only. Moving to page three, our Q2 2020 key highlights. Bottom line results for Q2 are better than budget. Our actual bottom line through Q2 is $36.6 million or $9.1 million better than budget. We are seeing the impact of lower retail revenues, primarily in the commercial sector, and lower long-range cost-based power contract revenue due to the lower operating costs that we're experiencing. And that is more than offset by the lower operating costs overall as we spend a little bit slower, as you've heard through the performance plan. Our forecasted bottom line results for the year are better than budget. We are forecasting currently to end the year at $60.2 million or $4.1 million better than budget. We are expecting the retail revenue to continue to be lower below budget, but we are expected to accelerate some of our spending. So we'll see that reflected in our financial statements, ending the year above budget, but a little bit closer to budget than what we're experiencing in Q2 so far. There have been slight adjustments in the forecast due to COVID-19 and naturally as we go through the process. So there are expected to be some schedule impacts, and the timing of some of the expenditures are moving out, and as you'll see, those reflected in the financial numbers. The district financial metrics are being met, with borrowing expected in 2022, which is consistent with Q1, to help fund a portion of our capital spending going forward. So while we continue to be nimble and adjust accordingly and adapt to the circumstances around COVID-19, we are staying the course with our new 2020 through 2024 strategic goals. Moving to page 4, specifically on financial impacts related to COVID-19, as mentioned, our bottom line results are forecasted to be slightly better than budget. While we did experience slow spending through Q2, we are expecting to pick that up. We're learning how to adapt to the best we can with COVID-19. We're expecting to get back on track a little bit closer to budget with expecting from our operating revenue or operating expenses expectations. But that's going to continue to be offset by those retail revenues that are going to continue to be below budget. The commercial sector is probably the area that's impacted the most, from a retail perspective, coming in at 92% of budget as forecasted. Through Q2, it's about 82% of budget. Some of the capital and O&M projects have experienced delays. As we adapt to the new and changing circumstances, we'll have to continue to adapt those forecasts accordingly. But as we know today through Q2, you'll see those numbers have reflected based on the best of our ability of what we know today. So these results do demonstrate our resilience achieved through our prudent financial policies, strong cash position, risk management and hedging policies. And I'd also like to note the business continuity plans that we've worked on over the last several years are coming into play this year. And certainly all of those actions help enable us to get through this COVID-19 period. Moving on to page 5, looking at the income statement on the revenue side, particularly, service revenue is below budget about $4.7 million, primarily due to the market element of our off-system sale is slightly below budget because of the wholesale price. Rates are slightly lower than what we've experienced in the past, but by design, that contract is intended to have full cost recovery. We are seeing our commercial sales down slightly because of load impacts, not only due to COVID-19, but also through mild winter weather conditions that we experienced earlier. The HDL growth continues to lag behind expectations as well, kind of rounding out the impacts of our service revenue. Net wholesale revenue, they have had the benefit of more surplus to sell because the usage is down on the retail side. So they are a little bit above budget, and some of those benefits have helped offset some of the lower prices from the Mid-Sea wholesale perspective. Hydro long-term contract revenue is below budget, $6.8 million, primarily due to the slower spending. Production costs are much lower, so we're feeling that certainly on the revenue side. Other operating revenue is in line with budget. Total revenues are forecasted to be about $60 million below budget for the year. On the expense side, operating expenses are slower, down about below budget, about $18 million. As we heard in the performance plan, C10 and C11, those projects have been delayed and pushed out to future years so we can focus some of the work on C2 and C7 through C7. We are expected to accelerate some of the spending that we've seen a little bit slow during the first two quarters. We are expecting to be about 93% of budget overall by the end of the year. Non-operating net expense better than budget, a little under $1 million due to the benefits of lower interest expense on our variable rate debt. Total net expenditures for the year expected to be below budget by $20.2 million. So bottom line, forecasting to be $60.2 million or $4.1 million better than budget. Through Q2, better than budget by $9.1 million. Reduction in expenses is greater than the reduction in revenues for to have that positive result. Moving on to page 6, on our looking at capital first, we've spent nearly $36 million in capital. However, this is about $16 million below our planned pace. For the year, we're expected to be about $28 million below our budget, spending about $136 million. So we have a lot of spending to do in the last two quarters of the year. We are seeing some slowed projects, certainly Rocky Reach and CM facilities. We've moved about $10 million out to future years, along with the Rock Island Power House 1 efforts that are going on that are getting delayed and moving some of those expenditures out forward to future years. But overall, we, you know, Rock Island modernization, the facilities, and some of the distribution work around substations are really driving the lower spend at this time of the year and forecasted. On the cash side, ending Q2 at $703 million. This is up from year-end, about $88 million, primarily to the net proceeds associated with the May bond issuance and refunding of $103 million. We are forecasted to be at $633 million at the end of the year, so we're going to continue to draw down that cash to pay for our some of our capital program. On the debt side, total debt is at a net increase of $52 million from the year-end balance, mostly driven by the impact of the plan of finance that was executed in May. We did see some offsets to that of $23 million in scheduled principal payments. So we are forecasted to end the year at $507 million, about $73 million above budget from a debt perspective. But a lot of that is by design because we do have some flexibility. We pushed out some of those retirements out into 2021. So we have some more flexibility to leverage that cash to adapt to changing circumstances in 2020. Moving on to page 7, looking at our bottom line results from a forecast perspective. I'll try not to get too repetitive here, but the service revenue is down and continues to be down through the forecasted part of the remainder of 2020 with some drivers, as mentioned. Primary impact, you know, the HDL is just lagging a little bit behind, and then we've had some impacts in the commercial sector as well with usage. Net wholesale revenue is materially right on line with budget, thanks to our hedging program that we have put in place. The hydro long-term contract revenue is still going to be below budget at 95% for the year, but with our spending picking up towards the last two quarters, we're certainly moving forward from a revenue perspective against budget versus where we were at in Q2. On the other operating expenses, again, trying to move forward with the Q3 and Q4 and should expect to see our spending get us closer to budget by the end of the year. So overall, bottom line, $60.2 million is our current forecast, over budget by 107%. Moving to page 8 on our bottom line results from a business line perspective. So you can see the driver is really Integrated Electric coming in with our current forecast at $59 million. I would note that fiber and telecom, water and wastewater, we are seeing the impact of implementing our 2020 through 2024 strategic planning guidance, which is moving them towards more self-sustainability, which includes reduction of their shared cost support. So you'll see those results reflected in those bottom line results. Moving to page 9 on the capital expenditures, as mentioned, through Q2, spent about $36 million, anticipating to spend $136 million by the end of the year, or 83% of the overall budget from a capital expenditure perspective. Highlighting a couple areas, electric distribution, their spending has been slowed with some of the substation work, vehicles, expenses, or capital expenditures getting pushed out in future years. I would note that from a forecast perspective, our network transmission group is expected to meet their capital plan. So they're forecasting to be slightly above. It's really too early to tell, so we may come back to the board with a budget revision at some point, but still too early to tell. But good news there in being able to accomplish their capital plan as forecasted. The Rock Island, you can see the majority of the capital spending occurs there with Rock Island, forecasting to spend about $71 million or 91% of budget. The internal services, as I mentioned, that's where the Rocky Reach and Central maintenance, the $10 million move into future years is driving that being below budget, forecasted to be about 74% for the year. On the fiber and telecom, we are forecasting them to be above budget and similar to network transmission. Still too early to tell, but we'll come back with a budget revision if needed as we move throughout the year. So overall, we have significant spending forecasted to occur in Q3 and Q4, ending the year about 83% of spend. Moving to page 10, looking at our 2020 cash flow, $37 million bottom line results. When you add back the non-cash items, our estimated earned funds from operations is $60 million. We did spend $36 million in capital expenditures. We have the net debt activity contributing $45 million to that, and then the impacts with respect to accounts receivable and accounts payable, adding back $88 million to our cash reserves, ending the quarter at $703 million. Moving to page 11, our cash and investments balance. Just to highlight a couple of things, our unrestricted funds as of Q2 is $442 million. That does include the $50 million of board designated funds for the headquarters and service center. The next item, restricted funds, this is associated with our long-term contracts. We are continuing to spend down from a capital perspective, so reducing those restricted funds to help with our capital program. The one item that is different from year-end and also from Q1 is the construction fund. So we do have $90 million of restricted cash that is earmarked for construction funds regarding the 2020 bond activity. And again, ending the quarter at $703 million. Moving to page 12, looking at our financial policies. This is consistent with Q1 reporting. You'll see the items in red, or in yellow, excuse me, starting in 2022. The yellow is an indication that we're within 10% of those financial metrics. This is also an indication of when we plan to start issuing debt to help fund a portion of our capital spending program. Moving to page 13, looking at our business line financial policies. As you recall, through the 2020 through 2024 strategic plan, in an effort to move these systems more towards self-sustainability, these metrics were put in place to help gauge and track that progress. You'll see with the water business line, operating coverage is slightly ahead of its metric. So that's a good sign. It's yellow just because we're within 10% of that metric. You'll see on the cash reserves, we are below our target in 2024, and that's due to the timing of our capital spend. You'll see our debt service as a percent of revenue is green and does have some room. So we may want to consider at some point internal borrowing to help shore up those cash reserves numbers associated with water, but that's a future discussion and decision. Moving to page 14, looking at wastewater. Similarly, they're within 10% of their metric, but they are achieving it at 63.3% in 2024. Their cash reserves are well ahead of their target. We do have some flexibility with how we manage the debt service. We have the Peshastin loans. You can see that's driving that metric to be red. And we're also waiting for more information regarding the Dryden facility and what that means from an obligation to the district from not only a cash perspective, but kind of how that will play out. So future decision-making with respect to wastewater as well. Moving over to page 15 on the fiber business line, similarly to the other two, We're at 82.1%, so within 10% of the metric, but we are achieving it. And cash position is strong at $13.3 million. Moving over to page 16 with our quarterly investment report, the district yield through Q2 is at 2.545%, slightly lower than Q1. We did have some benefit of the bond activity that is lifting that yield up slightly. We do expect that to go down in Q3. But we are meeting all of our investment policy objectives and are compliant with all of our metrics. Moving to page 17, Q2 key messages. As mentioned, our year-end 2020 forecasts are better than budget. Ended Q2 better than budget by $9 million, and we are expected to catch up with some of our spending towards the latter part of the year, but we still are anticipating to continue to have lower revenues all overall, but expecting to exceed budget from a bottom-line perspective at the end of the year. So as mentioned, the forecasts have been modified. There is uncertainty that remains based on what we know today, but as we learn more, we're going to continue to adjust those forecasts. The long-term financial metrics remain strong. We are assuming borrowing, as mentioned, in 2022 to fund a portion of our capital spending while maintaining our financial metrics. So at this point, our recommendation is to stay the course with the 2020 through 2024 strategic plan goals, but recognize that we're under unusual circumstances, certainly, and we have to be nimble. We have to be able to adjust accordingly. But so far, we're planning on staying the course. So with that, are there any questions?
Commissioners, questions for Mark? Well, that's a lot of information. Thank you for sharing that, and thank you for being diligent and continuing to watch as COVID, of course, changes our plans. And I appreciate the fact you're recommending staying nimble, because I think that's the only way through this. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I agree. The forecasts are adapted to what we know today, but given the uncertainty of what could come tomorrow, we certainly have to adjust and certainly want to move our projects and our work and our district's objectives in a safe manner.
We are in really good shape right now relative to our start of year budget. And, of course, we took the actions as part of the bond financing to increase our liquidity as well. So should there be some big unexpected event, we're in a good cash position right now. With that, Commissioners, I'm ready to make the transition to our next agenda item, which is a quarterly update from the Fish and Wildlife Program.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. This is Aline Underwood, Manager of Fish and Wildlife. And with me here today is Vaughn Pope, our Senior Wildlife Biologist. So we've got two really exciting topics for today. Vaughn is going to start out talking about our osprey nest monitoring program. As far as I can tell, it's been a while since we've come to you to chat about this really important program that we do to improve and enhance our reliability. And then I'm going to give an update on our habitat conservation plan, Rock Island Confirmation Study. And then the last thing is I'll give a quick update on the 2020 fish passage count. So with that, I'll turn it over to Vaughn, and he can talk to you about osprey.
Vaughn, you may be on mute.
Yep, I'm on mute. No, so now I'm off. Thank you, Aline, and good morning. I'm going to give a brief overview of our osprey nest monitoring program. This is a voluntary program that we do in conjunction with our avian protection plan, which we just updated this year to include a lot more information about osprey nest management because we've seen quite an increase in that. So, and the purpose of the program is really to provide better reliability on our electric system to identify problems before they become issues and manage them before they become a real problem either for our electric system or for the osprey, which are protected under state and federal law. So I'll give a little bit of information about the program that we've been doing since 2006, goes up through this year, and mainly focuses on increasing populations and the risks that come with those, and then a little bit about what we do to manage the nests. So slide four. So this shows the number of nests that the Wildlife Department has been monitoring on or around our distribution system since 2006. You can see there's a steady increase in the number of nests monitored, and that's not the result of an increased effort, although it has taken more effort. And if you'll hit the slide again, Rebecca, we've had about a 400% increase in our effort from 2006 to 2019, 2020, in our effort to monitor all these nests. So certainly it's a reflection of an increasing population of osprey. And next slide, page five. The location of those birds is evident here on this slide. Traditionally, osprey nest in snag trees. They like to be up at the highest point with not much around them. And as you can see in this slide, even the numbers that are in green are increasing. So we have an increasing number of osprey showing up on snag trees, but there's a tremendous increase there in purple in the nest platforms. And those are the platforms that we're setting up off of our system to keep the birds off and give them a place to nest that's not on our system. You also see quite an increase in the number in red, which is on our transmission system. The transmission lines are built such the spacing is wide enough that there has been no issues with osprey nesting on our transmission lines to date. It's primarily a distribution system. And then the gold bars there are other structures, which include a lot of random places like bridges, buildings, communication towers, light poles, anything that is high up and kind of on its own where the osprey can build their nest. Next slide. So with this increasing population comes increasing risk. The risk is to both the birds, which are protected under state and federal law, and to our system. They bring a lot of sticks and different material to the typically distribution or transmission poles. And on these, on the photo on the left, you see the transformers there. That stick material can get down into those grounded components, and if it's touching the energized components, we can have an outage. Poses risk to the bird, our system, and on the slide on the right, you can see at the lower part of the slide that there was actually a fire started at this pole due to a nest that was built on the pole and shorted out. Some of the material fell down and caught the under vegetation on fire, which is something that that's the primary feature we're trying to avoid is risk to our system and starting any fires. Next slide. This is a pretty interesting slide that shows that some of the material that osprey bring to the nests are not necessarily benign from an electric delivery perspective. While there's a number of interesting items that they bring to the nests, you'll note that five of those are in red, and those are conductive items. So for whatever reason, the osprey do like to go get things like speaker cable, aluminum cans, and even guy wire pieces and bring them to their nest. And they have a particular affinity, it appears, for leather gloves. So this really increases the risk and the reason that we want to try to keep them off of our electric distribution system. This particular nest blew over in a windstorm. It's the nest that's out at the railroad switching yard on the south end of Wenatchee. So the nest blew over in the wind. It's been there. That nest has been there for probably 15 years, and the top half blew out, and that allowed us just to go in and kind of dig around and look and see what the contents of the nest were, and it was much more than just sticks. Next slide. So what do we do about these nests on our system? The first thing we do is just try to remove the nest. So the osprey come back in April, and the wildlife department is out late March, early April, going to all these known territories and looking for any problems, because quite often our problems show up adjacent to a known nest site within a quarter mile or so. So we just go out and tour the known nest sites and look for any problems. We'll also get information from line crews or customers that will tell us about osprey nests, and we go out and investigate those. And our initial attempt is to just remove the sticks and see if the birds will do something different. There is some success with that, but more often than not, the birds are determined to nest on the system, and they're determined to do that, and it's not safe for them, and it's a risk to our electric system. We set up these osprey platform poles like you see on the left. This gives the birds a place to nest off our system and reduces risk to them and our customers as well, and us for our infrastructure. Since we started installing these platforms at a higher frequency due to the number of nests that we're seeing on our system, we've noticed that Canada geese are now starting to take over some of these nests that we put up for osprey. So we now have a nest management program to keep the geese out of the osprey nests. Next slide, slide 9. So in this program, for those structures, nest platform structures are very near water, which there's about 12 currently. Every year in the late winter, typically February, we'll have the line crews go up and cover the nest platform. They put a boat buoy in the nest itself, and then they cover it with this tarp. That keeps snow load and a lot of ice and debris from, too much weight load on the structure. And it keeps the geese out. So the geese come to nest in mid-March, and the osprey don't come back until April. So if the osprey return and the geese are in the platform, the osprey will go try to build a nest at the next best structure, which is usually one of our electric poles. So we cover these nests until about the 1st of April, and then we take them off, and it's been pretty effective at keeping the geese out but making them available once the osprey return for the nesting season. Next slide. So that's just a quick overview of what we're doing to monitor the problems, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Vaughn, this is Randy Smith, and fascinating presentation. I learned a ton reading this, and I'm glad to hear it from you. The question that sort of emerges in my mind, looking at how successful we've been, when do we get to the point when we can no longer expand and have, it seems like the way the birds are expanding, we could create a whole lot more work for ourselves at some point. When do we say we've reached stability?
Well, so ideally, from a population perspective, we would hit a population level where the birds just aren't, they aren't able to, there's only so many pairs that can be in an area, and we'll hit that. And it seems like every couple of years we get there. We have these large jumps every 3 to 4 years, it seems like. And I've been real hopeful that we're going to get reach capacity for the population and stop having to do this. The real challenge we have is that from a regulatory perspective, we have to manage our risk with regard to taking protected species. And there's also the if we stop doing things, our line crews are very adept and efficient at keeping birds off of a particular pole. But then they move to the next pole, and then they move to the next pole. So while we're able to keep them off the poles we don't want them on, it takes a lot, of management in that avenue. So what we're doing may be offsetting some of that, but it is challenging because we need to protect the system and our risk with regard to regulatory issues. We are looking into some potential permits with WDFW as part of our revision to our avian protection plan this year. DFW, from a state perspective, is our biggest risk from a regulatory perspective, and we are looking into some options with them. But while there's an increasing population and they continue to use our system, we'll need to try to protect it.
Thank you.
Commissioners, any other questions?
Yeah, hi. Ann Congdon, Vaughn.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. Hey, I just want to say thank you to you and your team for and all the linemen for your great efforts to, you know, to preserve the ability of these wonderful birds of prey to nest. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Anyone else have a question for Vaughn? Comment?
Okay, I think I'll go ahead and start the Rock Island Habitat Conservation Plan confirmation study update part of the presentation. Again, this is Aline Underwood. We last came to you in April of this year in our last quarterly update. To give an update on the purpose of the HCP check-in, we also indicated at that time that we were planning to do a check-in at both Rocky Reach and Rock Island in 2021, but we didn't know if that would be possible given schedule delays due to COVID. So we told you we'd have that decision made by June. We did make that decision to defer the Rocky Reach project confirmation study to 2022. Given the project schedules there, but to remain focused on conducting our study at Rock Island in 2021. We went to the Rocky Reach Habitat Conservation Plan Coordinating Committee in June to request their authorization for that. They agreed that that was the right thing to do, and they felt confident in the operation at Reach to go ahead and shift that check into 2022. So we fast and furiously worked to get our Rock Island request for proposals released on June 17th. This, frankly speaking, there is no statutory requirement that has us put out an RFP, request for proposal, for the services to conduct the Rock Island study. However, given the large dollar amount that we're talking about contracting for and the importance of that study, we agreed that soliciting folks to submit a proposal on that work would be the best interest of the district. We went ahead and published that proposal on June 17th. The deadline was July 17th, and we were happy to report we received four proposals. All four proposals met the required criteria that we set forth, which I'll talk about here in just a second, and we're in the process of reviewing those now. So on the next slide, you can see our confirmation study schedule. So I've crossed off the things we've already done. Currently this week, we are still evaluating the proposals that we received. We have sent additional information to the proposers, attempting to clarify some items that they've included in the RFP. We hope to conclude that work either the end of this week or next week. We hope to have an interim selection of a contractor still yet this month, and our goal is to come to you all to award a contract in September. I have listed September 8th here, but because we are really taking our time to make sure that we're doing all of our due diligence on the proposals, it's very much likely that we will punt to the next meeting in September. That would be the September 21st meeting. So on the next slide, I wanted to chat a little bit about how we are evaluating the criteria. So first off, what we've asked each of the proposers to do is a couple of things. What we've asked them is to tell us how they can assist in the study design, to work with our internal staff our statistician that we've hired and our HCB coordinating committee to develop a robust study plan that meets the requirements outlined in the HCP in terms of precision and standard deviation to make sure the study is valid. Secondly, we've asked them to deploy and remove all detection equipment with the caveat that we will install and remove detection equipment that is put directly onto the project at Rock Island, but the contractor is responsible for doing any of the work in the forebray and the tail race and further down to be able to measure project survival. Third, we asked them to activate their proposed tag technology as well as implant those tags into the test fish. And then finally, their last scope will be to process the data that they get, and there will be a large volume of data with all of the detections with the tags that they implant, and then to do the report writing when the study is conducted. So again, the study will be conducted in the spring of 2021. We want to get a contractor on board now for a couple of reasons. There are some things that the contractor can do early to get ready to deploy the tag technology and the parts in 2021. We also need to develop the study plan this year with the coordinating committee. So that's why we're starting now. We would probably have very preliminary results of the study as soon as August of next year to be able to determine if we have met the rigor that's required in the study plan and whether or not we have achieved the survival standard that we're hoping for. So in this slide, the proposed evaluation criteria, this is listed in the RFP. These are the things that we are ranking the proposers on. And you can see the possible points. So the ability to perform the required tasks that I laid out that the contractor is responsible for. We've asked for the experience of the key staff in similar projects. And there have been many similar survival study projects done along the Columbia, the main stem, and other systems in the Northwest. We want to know the resources available to conduct the work, both from a staffing perspective and things like boats and equipment necessary to conduct. Part of the proposed evaluation criteria is certainly a not-to-exceed price, but you'll note that it's not the only thing that we look at, but it is very important to understand what the proposed price is. And then in order to streamline the service agreement processing at the back end of this, we included a draft of our standard terms and conditions on any contract, and we will rate them based on their ability to meet those draft terms of the contract. That's what allows us to make a selection and then hopefully draft up the contract and get it before the Board of Commissioners in such a quick fashion. So on the next slide, this is primarily, we're not seeking any approval from the board today. This is merely an update on where we're at. We will like to come back to, well, we do plan to come back to the board, potentially September 8th, but as I mentioned, more likely the 21st, to ask for approval to execute the contract with the successful proposer to conduct the work in 2020, well, beginning this year and in 2021. So before I move on to adult fish returns, does anyone have any questions about that process and what we're trying to do? Okay. So with that, I would just like to give a quick update on the next slide, which is the adult fish returns at Rock Island. If you recall, at the fall update that we did in 2019, we presented a pretty robust look back on the adult fish returns at Rock Island last year. This is merely a snapshot of that, given that a lot of our returns are still in progress. But I thought it worth pointing out a couple of things. So these are adult fish returns at Rock Island. The reason we don't report them to you at Rocky Reach is because obviously we have the Wenatchee tributary and we do have a lot of spring Chinook, summer Chinook, coho, well, frankly, all of these species that go into the Wenatchee. to fulfill their life history. So this is the easiest thing for us to do, is to report at Rock Island. So a couple of notable things. I've included the 2020 count as of July 26th. That was sort of the last date I looked. There have been additional passage numbers since then. For where I have included the 10-year average, that is a 10-year average at the same date stamp of July 26th. And I should have put that in that column heading, but it's not the complete 10-year average that we'll get once we get to the very end of the season. So that's important to note. I haven't included the percent of average at Rock Island for most of the species because, as you can see, they are in progress. And then as last year, we will include a percent of average at Bonneville, only to give context for, you know, the trends that we're seeing not only in our project, but in the lower river as well. So a couple of things I wanted to point out. We are finished with the spring Chinook season. The quote cutoff date for spring Chinook is typically around the 21st of June. After that, they're considered to be summer Chinook. So we are at, so that 10-year average is representative of what we see as a typical 10-year average, and that won't change because we passed that June cutoff date. And it is very low, and you can see that in 2019, we were also at about 49% of average. One thing I am happy to report is that the sockeye return is greater than forecasted. They have updated that forecast several times. And that today, a sockeye fishery actually opened in Lake Wenatchee. We are expecting, I think it was 31,000 sockeye. I think we're up to maybe 33,000. And 25,000 are what's needed to open that fishery. So with that, are there any questions about the adult fish returns?
Hey, this is Steve McKenna. A question of between the spring and the summer Chinook. As I look at the data here, the summer Chinook is above the average, but our spring Chinook is below. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. That's a really good question. So, yes, our summer Chinook are doing really well. Spring Chinook, obviously, they are listed as endangered on the endangered species list. And so primarily what separates the spring Chinook from the summer Chinook are their phenotypic characteristics and where they spawn. So spring Chinook often are, their run timing is much earlier than summer Chinook. They typically are smaller, and they go to the highest tributaries to spawn. So the species was listed in 89 with steelhead, and since then we have had some ups and downs in terms of returns. What we suspect is that, like many of these species, they are highly affected by ocean conditions. The majority of the time that they actually spend in our rivers here is very, very short. So summer Chinook just have a higher abundance overall. And the summer Chinook are not listed. They have a very different life history characteristic. They also outmigrate very differently than spring Chinook. So when spring Chinook outmigrate as juveniles, there's a very tight time frame that they are in the main stem river and then go to the ocean. And this is actually the time that we do our survival study. And for 2021, we've chosen yearling Chinook here to do that. So we're talking a max of 6 weeks. Summer Chinook tend to migrate throughout the entire sort of spring, summer season. That's why we see our different spills at Rock Island and Rocky Reach. So when we are spilling at Rocky Reach, it's actually for summer Chinook. And when we increase our spill at Rock Island from 10% to 20%, it's for summer Chinook. So they have a much longer out-migration pattern. They also spend a bit of different time in the ocean, and they travel to different places in the ocean. And when they come back as adults, they tend to spawn in the lower parts of the tributaries, and they don't go up as high into the system. So that's one of the reasons why they're not listed under the ESA, is their abundance numbers have never been as low as spring chinook.
So a chinook coming, say, for example, up the icicle, is that considered a spring chinook or a summer chinook, or I guess both?
It depends on what time of year it is. So, and it also depends on, I mean, they do, even though they're both chinook, they do look very different. They do have different genetic composition. Mm-hmm. So if it's very early in the year, let's say in the icicle, it would be close to May or June. It's very much likely a spring chinook.
Okay.
And that's actually go ahead.
I apologize. And when are they considered steelhead?
Well, steelhead are a completely different fish, and they return at very different times. So steelhead return in two sort of pulses, if you will. There's a return that is in the way we think about it is in the fall. So steelhead, the steelhead numbers you're seeing there, the 727, those are steelhead that did pass sort of this early winter. So that would be February, March, April to get to the spawning grounds. The next pulse of steelhead that we'll see this year will actually occur in the fall. So steelhead are different in that when they return to the tributary to spawn, or even the main stem Columbia, they don't spawn until the following year. So they'll come in, and then they will look, if they come in this fall, they'll look for places to kind of hunker down through the winter, and then they will spawn next spring. However, summer chinook and spring chinook, they spawn the same year that they come in. So spring chinook come in earlier. They start spawning around the middle of August. Summer chinook come in later. They start spawning about the beginning of to mid-September through October.
Thank you.
Maybe
there's more setting.
Pardon?
Hi, this is Ann. Arlene?
Hi, Ann.
Ann Congdon. Hi. Very interesting. I always learn something new whenever you report. Yeah. So interesting how different the migration patterns are and the genetics are for spring and summer chinook. It's just curious to me why they'd be chinook, but called chinook, but be so different.
Yeah, they are very different species, and I mean, like I said, they have very different physical attributes. Different life history. And so, yeah, the differences between them two can seem pretty minor, but if you look at them, you can actually see the difference.
Interesting. So one odd question. Did you always like fish? Did you always want to study fish?
I have always enjoyed all sorts of outdoor environments. Fish is just one of those things in the ecosystem that is part of a greater love that I have, and so that's just part of that.
Well, good for you. I have always loved everything outdoor, too, insects, plants, birds, but not fish. So I'm glad those of you who do love the fish. Anyway, great job. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Elaine, Gary Arsenault here.
Hi, Gary.
Hi. On the counts for coho, is that because coho hasn't come in yet, or why is that such a blurry number?
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. That is exactly what it is. Coho have not yet started they've started the migration in the lower river. They have not yet made it to Rock Island. They are a fall migrating species, so we typically see most of our coho in September, October, and through November.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Commissioners, if there are no other questions, this would be a good moment to consider taking the lunch break. We do have two items left on the study session. Both of them will take some time, and so I would suggest it's probably not a good time to start those right now. What I would propose is that we bring them up after we get through the resolution, which I expect would go fairly quickly because we have only a very small amount of presentation material, and the one item that we've got is one that has been discussed previously by the board. So I would expect we would get to it by 10 after or 1:15 to these other two items. Is that okay with the board?
Commissioners, is that satisfactory?
Okay.
Yes, thank you. You bet. Okay, by me.
All right, Steve, it sounds like this would be a good point then to recess for lunch, and we will begin our business session then at 1 o'clock. Okay. We are recessed. Thank you, everybody. Welcome to the August 3rd, 2020 business session of the Chelan County PUD Commission. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in this afternoon. In the spirit of social distancing due to COVID-19 virus, today's meeting will be conducted by telephone. Members of the public that may be on the phone are encouraged to make comments and ask questions. If you do wish to speak, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. I will open the phone lines later on in the business session. So, commissioners, we have before us a consent agenda. Is there a motion to accept the consent agenda?
I would move to approve the consent agenda.
It's been second. Moved. Second?
Yes.
So it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion at this time? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of approving the consent agenda, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The ayes have it. I think, Steve, do you want to move on to the regular agenda at this point, or do you like to circle back to the study session item 7 and 8?
I'd like to go to the regular agenda and take care of the item 13.
All right.
This is a resolution authorizing the issuance of a guaranteed maximum price amendment, GMP amendment, to Absher Construction Company of Puyallup, Washington, to provide site work, construction of the general contractor, construction manager, GCCM services for the service center project. And we've got Dan Frazier and David Lodge to present today.
Good afternoon. David Lodge, project manager with engineering and project management.
Dan Frazier, director of shared services.
So this was the scope of work we presented at the last commission meeting, and the contract amendment that Steve just mentioned has been negotiated per the terms of the contract and RCW 3910 in the amount of $8,960,518, and this is for site work construction on the Service Center project. So this price is roughly $100,000 less than the number we presented at the last board meeting due to some last-minute revisions on the electrical scope of work. So, as always, the district is committed to creating opportunities for local participation, and especially with this work. And so I'm pleased to inform you that with this first authorization, 78% of this work will be awarded to local contractors. So two of those major subcontract packages are going to Pipkin Construction of East Wenatchee and Schmidt Electric of Wenatchee. So we'll continue to work with Absher Construction to create more bidding opportunities for local contractors in the remaining scopes of work. So upon execution of this amendment, Absher will begin the site work construction continuing through the end of this calendar year. And we intend to return in January with a second amendment for the building construction. And Dan, do you want to mention the groundbreaking ceremony?
Yes, commissioners, I'm assuming we're moving forward with this at this point, and I appreciate all the support we've gotten from the commissioners and from everybody throughout the process. And to celebrate this, we're having a virtual groundbreaking. I think you've all either been filmed or are going to be filmed to do the virtual groundbreaking on the release on Wednesday at noon on Facebook via Facebook, not Facebook Live, but Facebook event. And so we look forward to having everybody kind of view that, participate if they can virtually, and celebrate this really momentous step toward this great project and really something that's adding value to the district and for our customer owners.
Question. For those of us that aren't regular Facebook users, is it difficult to get onto that?
It is not. I believe that if you follow Chelan PUD on Facebook, it should be the event. Now, you can't use a district computer to get onto it, but you can with your personal device, and you'll be able to look at that event and watch it, watch the video.
Okay, thank you.
Dan, how long will that video be up and on Facebook and viewable?
I'm not sure if there's any potential retirement of it. Normally those, when they go up, they just cycle down through the, as we post new things, it just cycles down our page. So I think it'll be up there indefinitely and at least for an extended period of time.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, we're done with the regular agenda.
Okay, thank you, Steve. So at this time, we should move back to the...
We need a motion to approve, I think, on 13.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. Yes, do we have a motion to approve?
Yes, I so move.
It's been moved. Is it seconded?
I'll second.
Been moved and seconded. Do we have any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of the regular agenda resolution 13, please say aye.
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 Those opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. It's approved.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Well, thank you guys for the hard work that you're putting into this project. Really appreciate it. Steve, at this time, we should maybe take a look at the two items that were from this morning's study session.
Yeah, I would like to do that. So we would go now to item 7, which is the public power benefit update relative to the fiber acceleration assessment process that we've gone through as a result of the strategic plan. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Bob Shane.
Thank you, Steve. Bob Shane, Interim Managing Director for the Fiber and Telecom Group. I'm here to present on the public power benefit acceleration assessment. No action is required at this time, but we are looking for your guidance and direction based on the findings that we present. Why are we here? On slide 2, we're asked to evaluate accelerating the public power benefit program. If you recall, it began in 2015 and it was forecast to be completed by the end of year 2026. And under that program, we were expected to reach 85% to 90% of the county with fiber access. And currently, we're at 76%. You might recall that part of our 2020 strategic planning outreach, we received customer input to expand the fiber. And in support of this, we chose to evaluate accelerating the fiber program. And this presentation is a response to that evaluation. Intuitively, broadband access would be available to more customer owners, obviously, but also allows our service providers on our system to achieve a larger service territory within the county, making them more competitive. We can see the interest in fiber continues to grow, as evident in our growing take rate. Right now, we're at 52%, which is pretty phenomenal for an overbuild. And so we do believe the fiber acceleration will be well received. I'll go into some high-level detail on what it would take to accelerate, considering our business unit priorities and commitments involved with the acceleration in the coming slides. And as I mentioned, we're seeking your guidance on the recommendation. Rebecca, the next slide, please. So can we accelerate the fiber expansion? A team was formed of those that would be directly involved in supporting the acceleration. We met with fiber team, the customer utilities, legal, procurement, engineering, project management, real estate services. where we looked at potential operational impact based on the workload and resource allocations for current and future work expectations under the desire to maintain current projects and priorities, but not increase staffing levels to support the acceleration. As part of the assessment, we considered different types of fiber acceleration combinations, if you would, to optimize the outcome. We looked at a whole or partial infill versus expansion, turnkey versus piecemeal, just to see if we could optimize the best solution set. Next slide, please. So consensus was reached. We decided that we could accelerate only a portion of the fiber program by 2 years. The proposal is to accelerate in 4 areas of the county, or in terms of the infrastructure, 7 new towers that I'll describe in a little more detail later. The expansion represents an estimated 1,274 new premises lit by the end of 2024, with PPP-funded service connections completed in 2025. If you recall, service connections are made available 2 years under the program, and that's why the connections will run into the 2025 timeframe. The team does
question.
Not rec- Is there a question?
Yeah, there is.
Oh,
on that
okay.
Yeah, on the 1,274 premises, that's additional over what we would normally be doing?
No, these are within the scope of the original PPB scope. So these are not additional to what we originally had allocated. We had roughly 9,200 premises identified in that overall project scope. We're actually at running around 9,700 now in reactuality because we are able to bring in more during the earlier parts of the program, but these are not additional. These are premises that were already identified within the scope of the original program.
Yeah, I'll go back to recall previous discussions about this, that we concluded that that last 10 to 15% was so expensive at a cost per premise pass that we couldn't justify moving into those areas. But the question is, could we take the ones that we're planning to do and try to get them done earlier?
Okay.
So okay with that? Do you want need anything else on that?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. So as I was saying, the team does not recommend accelerating the infill portion of the PPP program at this time, primarily because of the magnitude of the supporting electrical make-ready work is not known and would require a 30% design to really get a good answer or a good idea of what that impact would be. But we do think that infill should be evaluated for consideration, but only at a later date. A key outcome of the assessment, though, we did determine that we don't have the internal resource capacity to perform the engineering functions or the construction activities under the acceleration proposal, and therefore we are recommending the use of contractors for these services. This will help minimize priority impacts for projects already underway and planned. It also supports our desire not to increase staffing levels. Next one, please. So the planned areas for expansion are the south shore of Lake Wenatchee, which is north of the state park to 25 Mile Creek, Manson Dry Lake area, somewhat northeast of that area, Inyat Valley Road up to Ardenvohr, and the lower Blewett Pass, that is from 97, junction 97-2 and the Campbell Road. Next slide, please. How it can be done. So under the resources, we will use the engineering project management resources here within the district. There's lots of formality to that process that brings efficiency through the expertise of that team and a very good understanding of the procurement options. So we'll optimize on how best we would manage the contract in getting this work completed. We will be looking at external contracted services, as I mentioned, for the engineering and design components of it. We already do the pole assessments and analysis external. That will continue. And more specifically, the construction for the fiber installation and the electric make-ready work would fall under this acceleration program. Next slide, please. In terms of the schedule, we're looking at in 2020 would use the normal resource planning to allocate resources for the following years. In 2021, we will do the procurement and engineering design specifically for this program. And then in 2022 and 2024, we would do the construction of the
which is both the make-ready work and the fiber installation. Next slide, please. So the funding, the original estimates that we have in our program were based on what we did in 2016, and resources were identified using internal resources for the fiber program. So the necessary electric make-ready work is already currently estimated to be used using external contractors, so there's no real additional funding required for the make-ready work associated with the acceleration since it was already scheduled in their forecast. So the additional funding required is $2 million for the fiber portion of it, which would revise our expansion program, which is $25 million now, to $27 million. The PPP funding, which you will hear more about this in a later detailed PPP funding update, but for now, we're looking to move the existing $4 million that's under that program into 21 to start the process sooner with the existing planned $4 million for what we did have planned in 21, totaling up $8 million. The key thing there is there's only a shift between years, no impact on the $27 million total. Next slide, please.
Bob, just a quick question just for clarification. So what you're saying is the $4 million of PPP money for 2020 would be moved into a planned $4 million for 2021, and that combination, that's how you get to the combination of $8 million, right?
That's correct.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And an additional question. I'm making the assumption that the additional $2 million to re-accelerate is because we won't be using our own crews, but we'll be using outside contractors.
That's correct. The majority of that money would be related to engineering design and the construction of both the fiber and the make-ready work. I'm sorry, the $2 million would be for the fiber design and the fiber construction. And not to make ready work. That's already accounted for in their forecast.
Well, I just want to get clarity because, you know, I mean, if we were already planning on doing all of this and all we're doing is accelerating, all of that cost you're talking about would have been already there at some point. It may be front loading. Well, what changes the bottom line, I guess, is of cost? Is it the outside contractor?
That's correct. The contractors for the engineering services and the construction of the fiber.
Okay, so you'd be contracting for the design also.
That's correct.
Okay, gotcha.
So we look at the key known unknowns. Contractor availability and timing assumed to exist for both the make-ready work that's required and the fiber system design. I want to pause here for a moment. You all have heard about there's quite a bit of interest in the nation to expand broadband across the country, and there's lots of money being put out, tens if not hundreds of billions of dollars. So we will be watching the availability of contractors to do this work for us. Once those fundings become readily available, it could be a challenge for us. So it goes with the second one, market conditions for contractor availability could impact costs. Our cost estimates are based on what we know today, but as the market becomes squeezed, the costs could go up based on market changes. The other part is the condition of the electrical distribution system is estimated. Until we start the actual design, we won't have an exact idea of what that impact would be. It could be higher, it could be lower. And, of course, availability and the ongoing involvement of internal resources will be needed throughout the project. So changes to the district's priorities could impact a scheduler cost. Next slide, please. So, in summary, we can accelerate the PPP expansion. It's the expansion areas only, not the infill that I talked about previously. The biggest change would be utilizing internal resources, moving away from internal to external resources for the completion. The additional $2 million would be for the expansion cost for the acceleration, not the electrical side of it. And again, shifting the funds, existing $4 million into 21, and adding an additional $4 million for 21 for the, what's currently scheduled for the expansion. Next slide, please. So we're seeking board feedback on the recommendation at the next board meeting. If recommended, it is accepted. Again, this is the repeat, but we'll allocate what's remaining in the 2020 PPP allocation as well as what's scheduled for 2021 for a total of $8 million. And the acceleration of the PPP fiber program will be included in the 2021 budget filing as a capital projects. Next slide, please. That is it. So we're
another
looking. Go ahead.
When we get done with this expansion, assuming we move forward, accelerated or not, what percentage penetration will we have achieved of the county?
We're forecasting 85 to 90%. We like to shoot for the highest number possible, and because of our, as the county grows, that's a bit of a challenge to keep up with it. Okay. But we are looking between 85 and 90%.
Okay. And the infill areas are all very difficult to achieve. That'll be after the fact, I understand.
Both the expansion and infill are happening simultaneously. So every year we do a little bit of both, and we have that scheduled infill through 2026. The expansion that we're talking about would be completed 2 years prior to that. So,
okay.
We do both. And we mix and match as necessary to meet our resource needs or construction, or we look for efficiencies and where to build next based on what customer utility might be doing in their expansion work or in their electrical work.
Bob, this is Steve. I have a question for you. So give me an example of infill. I know we just gave notification for some folks up by Lake Wenatchee. Is that an infill project that we'll be doing there? Or I'm struggling a little bit with definition there of infill.
Sure. So when you talk about infill, infill is any work that we do that's immediately surrounded by infrastructure that we put in previously. So we're filling in gaps. So a good example would be here in Wenatchee, apartment complex, maybe of 20 or 30 or 40 premises. Under the original program, we failed to get them completed for a number of reasons. The funding was no longer available, or there were some significant costs involved with getting work related to feeding that particular complex, maybe a lot of asphalt work or concrete work to get there. So those areas were left unserved within the bigger group of the fiber program. So infill, now we're going in there and surgically going in and lighting up, providing fiber service to those individuals or groups of individuals within that infrastructure that were left behind. And the number of premises that we would pass can be as little as one, or as big as 50 or 60, depending on the complex, and even bigger. Where expansion is brand new infrastructure, it's really at the edge of our fiber program, where we're at the boundaries, and now we're actually going into new territory. That's the expansion part of it. The acceleration we're talking about is taking seven towers, which are expansion, and extending the size, the footprint of our fiber program by 1,274 premises.
Thank you very much.
Well, Ms. Gary Arsenault, I have a question for you just for clarity point. What percentage of build-out will we have accomplished by the end of 2021?
I'm going to say right now it's 77% by the end of 2021.
Okay. Thank you.
We're currently at 76, so what we have planned would take us to about 77%.
Great. Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
Well, I guess just a comment, observation that in the last many years, the
societal need for fiber has done nothing but accelerate. And so, yes, there's a cost associated with acceleration, but I'm pretty certain there's a cost associated with not accelerating, too, that we can't measure as easily. So I think it's time to get our expansion done if we can. One commissioner's opinion.
I agree.
Commissioners, this is John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. I just wanted to compliment Bob on a nice presentation and recognize that we've partnered and collaborated on this over the past couple of months, and we did come to that same conclusion. I feel we're in a good spot. We put some processes in place, as Bob identified. We had already planned on using external resources to support the expansion. One thing I want to just maybe point out is we are not rebuilding our system. This is to really do make ready work so it can safely handle the additional load of the fiber lines and meet minimum compliance of the National Electric Safety Code. So we feel confident that this program will get there, and we look forward to supporting it as best we can. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you, John. Appreciate that. I want to thank Bob for a great presentation today. Really glad that you're filling in for Mike, and you've of course got big shoes to fill. Mike did such a great job, but I will have all the confidence in the world in you, Bob, and look forward to having a lot more conversations about fiber. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary, and I'm working on that southern drawl. I haven't got that nailed yet.
That's good.
Hey, this is Ann Congdon.
Yes, Ann.
I want to congratulate you, Bob, on your appointment as interim director. And I just want to say that you come highly, highly touted and recommended by Mike Coleman. So congratulations.
Thank you, Ann.
You're welcome.
Commissioners, any other comments or questions for Bob?
Well, I just think this is Dennis, and I just think the expansion as rapidly as possible is, you know, in everybody's best interest. One of the things that COVID has done was laid bare several aspects of our society that need to be addressed and need to be addressed immediately. And one of them is certainly, how do you educate children, you know, in this day and age? And the digital divide, is rampant across this country, with basically less than half of our population, or right at half of our population, having access to some kind of broadband. And the definition of broadband varies significantly. And us being in the 70 percentile area, expanding closer to 85% for a rural county, puts us in a unique category. But it also outlines very clearly, you know, the work that Bob and his crews have to do, you know, to get us to that point. But it's such, as Randy has said earlier, such a necessary item in our society at this point. And like I say, if you take education as a singular item, if we're going to educate all kids in America, you know, we need to do our part. And I think this is part. So, Bob, glad you're on board, and look forward to working with you and taking a look at this expansion and doing what we can as soon as we can to make it a better world for the children that live in it.
Thank you, Commissioner. And again, without your support and foresight, we wouldn't be where we're at right now. So great appreciation to the board for that.
Commissioners, I'd like to finish with just one thought. So the strategic plan did call for a couple of different things. It encouraged us to think about this effort here, accelerating the fiber expansion program, and it also encouraged us to move towards first quartile in reliability. Part of the reason it's taken us such a long time to get back to the board on implementation of that plan is that there are challenges in terms of managing those two initiatives at the same time, because you're talking about basically, in many cases, the same poles or the same crews that are involved. So we think we've found a balance point to manage that. In addition, the board did decide that to take advantage of the fact that we've had some very good years financially and expanded the PPP program by $4 million to $6 million a year. Essentially, what's happening here is across a planned five-year period, about 20% of that additional revenue would go into the fiber program. So that certainly leaves room for other activities, but it's not an insignificant amount of that expansion. And I think that reflects the level of comments that we got in the strategic plan, where this was the number one issue that we heard about, where folks were interested in getting our attention paid to how quickly can we get to a fiber acceleration program. So with that context, again, today we're not asking for even a head nod. We will be bringing this back at the next board meeting to have that conversation, just so you have a chance to think about it and ask any questions after you've had that chance to soak in it. And our plan will be to come back at the next board meeting. Probably won't have much of a presentation, just to check in and say, are you comfortable with proceeding as we have discussed here?
That sounds good. Thanks, Steve.
Okay. With that, we are ready to move to agenda item 8, which is the infrastructure cost recovery approach, another item that comes out of the strategic plan, where we discussed how we will cover costs for infrastructure and particularly how we implement the growth plays for growth philosophy here. Lindsay Mons will be making this presentation.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Steve Mons, Business Manager and Customer Utility. As Steve mentioned, today we are discussing our infrastructure cost recovery approach, often referred to as growth pays for growth. This is an item that came out of the economic development portion of the strategic plan, where we were encouraged to maintain our line extension policies, but consider a standard fee for those larger items like substations and transmission, which are not typically part of cost assessed to our customers through their upfront fees. This is being evaluated. These standard fees are being evaluated by a contractor, FCS Group, which we talked about in my last presentation on the topic. But we do desire some feedback from the board today and thoughts to inform that study, because we do have several options as far as approach goes. So no formal action is needed today, but your feedback is definitely appreciated. So in addition to the strategic plan and economic growth driving this effort, it is also driven by some challenges that we're facing right now, as we are facing a time of increasing growth within our community. That growth, of course, drives need for power, and that creates all sorts of different impacts on our system. As you've heard before in our discussions on substations, we are kind of at the edge of capacity in some areas, which creates a challenge for our engineering group when they're evaluating what does growth pay for growth really mean. Those costs can be vastly different depending on location. If the same customer was interested in power on a substation that's near capacity versus one that has a lot of room, or along a line with a similar situation, that is a significantly different cost to the district and could be a significantly different cost to the customer. At times, those are large dollar amounts when requests do push the system beyond capacity. In these evaluations, currently we do not consider the impact of substation capacity, so we're not charging system fees for substations, with the exception of our cryptocurrency and HDL customers, or any of those customers that might come in over 5 average megawatts that are under different rate schedules. But as you know, substations are a substantial cost, and we run into questions along the lines of, well, we would never assess a single customer the full cost of a substation, of course, even if they pushed it beyond capacity. But what happens if it's a request for a 200-home development? You know, how is that different? And those are questions that our engineers, well, we wouldn't want them to make without your guidance for us. In addition, these costs can be difficult to determine and explain to our customers just because of all of these reasons I've explained to you why it's so difficult to develop them. So these challenges, I think this slide probably more so than what's driving the effort is should be titled Why Now? Why now? Because as we've experienced our community growth, but we've also met with our local municipalities here a couple weeks ago. We had a group meeting just to discuss what their plans were. And the common theme from everyone was growth and accelerated growth at that. Development within the city of Wenatchee and Eniat and Chelan, everybody is gearing up for growth both in their residential areas as well as commercial and industrial. Those municipalities have acknowledged the need for additional substations in their communities because they've heard from us through our efforts on other projects that those are things that we need to be talking about early and often. We also have just general organic community growth that's going on that's not even driven by anything in particular other than this wonderful place to live. And we have industrial and commercial expansion going on as well, participating with the port and other agencies in that area. Throughout our system, we have active projects, both in our organic residential. I don't know if my phone is ringing
Welcome
or can you
to
hear that?
Wireless. The wireless customer you called is not available at this time. Please try your call again later. Announcement 1, switch 222-1. Welcome to Verizon
Wireless.
On? The wireless.
You're still on, Lindsay. I'm not sure where that's coming from.
Try your call again later. Announcement.
Okay, but
one.
You can hear it too.
Two,
I don't.
Two, two,
just
dash
a second.
One.
Yeah, we can hear that. So we're going to give it a second and hope it will go away.
Okay.
There you go. You're up.
Sorry, that may have been me. Okay. I lost my call.
Oh.
Welcome back. Fantastic.
Sorry. All of a sudden, you disappeared.
Okay, so we are currently on slide 4 talking about growth in our communities and why this effort's of importance right now. On the active project examples, of course, we have our organic growth in residential and commercial, which we've seen impact in our discussions on substations in Chelan and Leavenworth, which really highlight the impact from a time and cost perspective of substation expansion and growth. We also have several projects in the planning phase, things like residential development in the West Wenatchee foothills. We have our HDL developments. So we have the Holly Street Stimmelt substation that's being constructed, which is another different approach to cost recovery in this area. This was one of the HDL customers over 5 megawatt situations where the construction is being funded and performed by the customer or their the landowner there or facility owner. In addition, we have mixed development. So an example here is the Mission Ridge project. We've heard plans or ideas to expand up at Mission Ridge, which of course puts pressure on our system as well. And even more so than in the substation area would be in the transmission. Getting the power to a substation at Mission Ridge is very impactful from a time and cost perspective. So all of these together with the challenges as far as creating cost drive the effort today. Just a quick picture for you to understand a little better and for customers who are listening to see kind of what we're talking about here. So this is a picture of our power system from the generation to the home. Of course, coming through our hydro project transmission lines and switch yards, those are all general costs that we allocate to customers through rates. But then the areas of our system that are being impacted most by this growth are the local substations, distribution lines, and the service to homes and businesses. So this is really where our discussion lands today as far as infrastructure cost recovery goes. As we're making improvements in these areas, how do we fund them? Do we fund them through rates, or do we fund them through fees, or a combination of the two? Currently, our approach is, if you're looking at this picture, charging our customers for line extension. So the houses at the end of the line, so it's either the line that goes directly from our distribution system to the house, or on the far right-hand side of the picture there, those two houses at the very end of the line, there could be some line extension costs associated with expanding the distribution line to those houses as well. And those are all standard things that we've charged customers for historically. As our system increases or reaches its capacity, occasionally we'll see other items along the line start to create limitations for power. So a large power user towards the end of a line might drive an increased a need for something like a voltage regulator or a section of line to be replaced. And those are the situations where our engineers are challenged the most in understanding who pays for that cost. On slide six, I think I've covered a couple of these already. So the line extension cost, our goal is 100% of cost recovery for those items. And then, as I mentioned, those larger requests can sometimes drive additional component costs to the customers before they're able to connect. In most cases, our substation cost impact are not assessed to those customers unless they're over that 5 megawatts. But this effort that we're going through right now with our consultant would consider what it might look like to charge a proportion of that substation cost to each customer that connects. So the next slide, please. So our cost recovery options are, of course, to continue our status quo, which is continuing those line extension costs, the case-by-case off-site costs, and then recovering any other costs such as substations or direct transmission through our retail rates to all customers. The other approach, which is discussed in the strategic plan, is the recovery through a standard fee for all new connections, which could be any number of things, but at the high end would be an equitable share of 100% of the substation distribution and associated transmission costs allocated to each of those customers based on the study that's being performed. Or we could charge a fraction of those backbone costs with the remainder included in rate requirements. Next slide, please.
Lindsay, can I just ask a question?
Of course.
This is Gary Arsenault. Is when you talk about infrastructure cost recovery options, are you also including the potential for a local improvement district bonding to pay for that? Is that one part of the consideration?
That could be part, but that is not one that we're evaluating right now. There are significant ongoing challenges and costs associated with that sort of funding approach that would really have to be evaluated from a pros and cons benefits associated with it.
Okay, thank you.
I will make note of it, however, if that's something the board is interested in learning more about.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
So similarly to our electric HEAP study, our consultant is also evaluating our water and wastewater system development charges, which are very similar to the electric efforts that we're undergoing at the moment. These system development charges have been in place for as long as I can remember, and it is a standard approach in water and wastewater systems. So these fees represent essentially the property owner's equitable share of the cost of the entire utility system, and not just the improvements specifically for their property. As you know, this is relatively new on the electric side, but just to note, water and wastewater are very common. So those charges will be updated, and the board will see results of that study as well when the consultant is complete. And I have a schematic here as well for the water system, just for that visual, as far as the costs that are included in an example water system SDC. So these components include from the wells, the storage tanks, all the pumps, the water mains, the valves, all of the essential equipment that gets the water to the home. So for our timeline on this effort, we'll continue to inform the study from our from FCS Group, which is our consultant in this area, based on feedback today. In September, we'll be engaging with key stakeholders on possible impact. So depending on what results start to look like, individuals from our development community in those areas. We're looking to understand parameters and options as far as different rate classes go and different approaches for residential versus commercial and how all those interplay together. Our study results are due at the end of September for all of our systems. And then November or later in the year, considering fees to be included in the 2021 or later fee schedules, depending on your thoughts. So with that, if there are other questions, I'm happy to address those.
Commissioners, any questions or comments for Lindsay?
I guess just a couple of comments, because Lindsay did indicate she's sort of seeking feedback today. You know, to put it in a nutshell, the economic development advocates would love for us to recover all of these costs through rates, and the ratepayers would love for us to cover, collect a lot of them through some type of fee. And so I think we're always probably going to have to search for some form of a balancing act. That's my thought. I don't know if the existing policy does that. Well, it says we recover it through the retail rate. There may be another method that applies part of it when new development occurs.
Certainly. So just a bit more information on that for you, Commissioner Smith. The fees that are being developed by our consultants are what would be considered maximum fees. So that would be the maximum that we could support charging our customers for these types of items. The board is always able to select something less, a different balance as far as how much of that you prefer to collect in a fee versus cost to remain in the system and recovered through rates. So that is definitely something we'll be talking more about as we go forward.
Seems like this is one of those areas where looking at a series of options would probably be a really good thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Dennis. I would support what Randy just said. I would like to see, you know, options presented in terms of costs and accountability and where this goes for maybe a, you know, developments with, you know, whether they're large or small or line extensions and, you know, the whole concept of equity and fairness, you know, also comes in. So, you know, yeah, I'd like to look at some options. I think we're on the right path, but it's time to get more specific and take a look at some concrete opportunities.
Yeah, let me say we are completely bought into the idea of presenting options to the board. I think that the way that both Commissioner Smith and Commissioner Bowles presented the issue is accurate. They're There's not a formula that tells you what the right answer here. It's a fairness and equity question, and hence it's really a ripe issue for the board to discuss. And so our thought would be to create some options, let you think about it, and then decide what represents fair here.
Commissioners, any more feedback for Lindsay? Well, Lindsay, I think we're all very anxious to see the next presentation and hear what you have discovered with respect to options and choices. The one theme that I did hear from my fellow commissioners is we're looking for a fair balance, but not certain of exactly what that will look like. So we're going to lean pretty heavy on you and your crew to help give us some choices.
All right. Thank you so much for your feedback today.
Thank you.
Now, commissioners, with that, we are finished with the makeup from this morning's study session items. And we do have quite a few manager's items we'd like to jump into. Some of them have some substance associated with them that might take a little bit of time. So if you're okay, I'm going to jump to those.
I think that's fine.
Okay. I'd like to start with Carrie Wendell with a COVID-19 update. What's that?
Good afternoon. This is Lindsay. Again, I'm actually going to take this for Carrie.
Okay.
As she's out of the office today.
Oh, so great. Thank you, Lindsay.
You'll get a little bit longer. You're welcome. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager in Customer Utilities, and we're talking about the COVID-19 customer impacts update today. This is our standard board report that we provide every board meeting. So the first information here is on our unemployment applications. As you see, we are still fairly steady in our initial claims numbers as a county. Things are pretty well leveled out in that area. And we do see the continued claims dropping, though perhaps leveling out a little bit in the last few weeks here. As a reminder, continued claims are those unemployment claims that have been previously filed, and those individuals continue to be eligible for unemployment. Within our own system, our PUD customers affected by COVID, we had three additional residential customers report impact in this two-week period. So that is also leveling out quite well. The customers with active payment arrangements, we do not currently have any remaining customers on payment arrangements. At our last report, there was one customer, and they have completed that plan. So for the monthly total, there are zero at month end. We also had six new additional customers approved for energy assistance through community action this period. From our past due accounts balances, we had a slight decrease in our residential balance. Our customer account specialists are putting a great deal of work into contacting these customers and letting them know that they have balances out there, and that while we are not currently charging late fees or disconnecting, that those balances still are owing at some point, so working with customers to begin paying down their balances. We do see that our customers with balances over $500 remain similar to the last report provided to the board. On the commercial industrial view, we have a fairly steady total past due account balances at a little over $36,000. However, at the end of last week after this report was prepared, there was a significant effort put into contacting those commercial customers, and I believe you'll see quite a large drop in this at our next report, potentially by a third. Additional notices, information on retail revenue past due or disconnect notices this month continue to go down slightly. Just for clarification, we do continue to print and send disconnect notices to our customers. However, we also include a communication to those customers that we are not actively disconnecting. This helps inform them, you know, where they are in our processes, should we get to the point of beginning those disconnect efforts again. Our total customers with active payment arrangements, these are beyond the ones I discussed that are COVID impacted, but so all of our other customers included in this number, we currently have 26 residential payment arrangements on file. For our past due accounts, we have 237 past due accounts as of the 28th, with 216 of those in our residential base. In our Helping Hands information, we do not yet have our July financial information from Community Action Council. We anticipate getting those balances and information here perhaps today or tomorrow. We do know, however, though, that 11 customers were approved for assistance through those programs. The big topic today is associated with disconnect and late fee waivers. So the district's program in this area expired at the end of the month. However, the governor's prohibition on disconnection and late fees was extended to October 15th for residential customers. So while we would continue that and in that effort, we also recommend continuing calling those customers on their past due accounts, letting them know where they are and working with them on payment arrangements, as well as referring them to Community Action for that assistance. We do continue to utilize our Helping Hand Fund, both with Community Action and through our customer account specialists. And we are providing up to a half assistance on their bills, up to $200. For those customers that we cannot reach via phone or email, we are providing door hangers so that they know we're trying to contact them. So because the district's program on disconnection expired and the governor's program only applies to residential services, we are evaluating options for resuming our normal credit and collection procedures for our non-residential customers. So these would be our commercial industrial customers that have not paid or are past due.
And I'll just note on that last item that customer relations made this significant improvement that Lindsay mentioned in terms of collecting on past due accounts in the commercial sector. And so that certainly has taken some of the pressure off with respect to evaluating options. So we're not feeling a need to bring forward something today. We'll be giving it some more thought and continue to talk about it with the board in future meetings. Any questions from the board about that?
Commissioners?
I would just like to comment that it appears that staff's doing an outstanding job being empathetic, and yet the numbers look like they're doing a good job helping people get things paid off, and it looks very positive in a tough situation. So I'd like to thank staff for their efforts.
Thank you, Commissioner McKenna. I will pass that on.
Okay, Lindsay, thank you. Next up, we've got John Stoll was going to give a report.
Hey, Steve.
Yes.
While we have Lindsay there, could I just ask, can I go back to cost recovery and while she's still here and ask a question?
Sure.
Lindsay, are you still there?
I am.
So I apologize for coming back, but one thing that would help me as we look at the choices that commissioners both and Smith talked about is, in my mind, I'm a mental model guy. I like the idea of a teeter-totter, that as you're looking for feedback from us and we have this delicate balance of what costs are incurred or what we charge for infrastructure, I would also like to be seeking feedback from you, you folks, from staff, on is there, in your, from your standpoint, is there anything that's pulling us out of balance? I mean, if I look at what we're doing financially, we're healthy, I want to keep things moving forward. I don't want to get, I don't want to, as a commissioner, to do something that gets us out of balance. So anything that, you know, staff can provide in the way of information from your vantage point as well that says, you know, this may be kind of tipping us one way or the other would be helpful to me. I don't know if that's helpful, but as I, that's the picture I have in my mind is we're evaluating, asked to evaluate options and get feedback.
Certainly, yes. And are you referring to out of balance as far as which, say, infrastructure improvements perhaps are the most impactful financially, or are you thinking beyond that?
As we look at differently from what we're currently seeing, you know, is the current model seems to be working well for us to keep it in balance, or is there something in that model that's tipping us one way or the other, you know, that's necessitating us looking at this and reevaluating, or are we just reevaluating as part of the thing
seems to be. All right. You were breaking up a lot on my end, so I will refer back to Rebecca's notes on this, and we'll certainly pull something together.
Okay. And, thank you.
Commissioner McKenna, I may be able, I think I caught enough to be able to give you a response. I think the fundamental driver that that causes this conversation to take place is that we have more growth going on, and we had economic development as part of our strategic plan. And so whereas historically it probably would have gone unnoticed as we added the cost of growth under our current policies, it may be more noticeable in the future. It's not so much a question as whether we can maintain financial health. I think it's really going to be more a question of the equities associated with how we get there. Hopefully that helps.
Great. Thank you. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'm going to turn to John Stoll, who's got a report on the Clackam Fire.
Thanks, Steve. The commissioners, it was Friday the 24th. You may recall we had a pretty active brush fire kickup around the Kingsbury Clackam Pass intersection, of course, on the south end of our county. We did have a serviceman we were able to dispatch right away to get out there. Key things to note, you know, this is at the end of our system, so but it also serves an area that relies on a lot of electric pumps for their water supplies, so we certainly wanted to be mindful of how we manage the system. We did put our system into a state where it wouldn't go into reclosing, but if there was a fault, it would lock it out. That way we could keep the power on and keep it as safe as possible. The fire advanced pretty quickly. We were on site, and at some point it impacted our lines probably early Friday evening, started burning down a few poles, and the power ultimately was disconnected. We did deploy crews. They were on site and, of course, partnered with fire service. And once it was deemed safe, later Friday night, early Saturday morning, we were able to go in there and quite rapidly restore a total of 14 poles that had burnt down. So I believe by about noon the next day on Saturday, power was back and restored to those customers. So again, good coordination between our crews and the fire service. We also have our general foreman lives up around the area and is very knowledgeable of the area, so he can serve as a go-between as well to support the effort with his local knowledge. So that's what I wanted to report.
Thanks, John.
Okay, and next up, Ron Slabaugh has got a report on some issues associated with regional water, and I know Commissioner Arsenault has been involved in this. There was a prior report on this back in February, and we do have an action item coming up for the board at a future board meeting. So, Ron?
Yes, thank you, Steve. We're speaking about specifically Commissioner Arsenault. You might recall we met with the Regional Coordinating Committee back in December. And East Wenatchee Water District was finishing up their comprehensive water plan, which we water utilities complete about every 6 years. And they were requesting to add about 1,000 acres to their service area. And as Steve indicated, we came back and presented that to our board during the February 18th board meeting. There was general agreement with that, provided that the East Wenatchee Water District paid for a couple of items. And one was the required amendment to the regional comp plan to increase that service territory. And the other is the required addendum to the regional comprehensive water plan for submittal to Department of Health, which also increases that service area. So we communicated that back to East Wenatchee Water District, and they submitted an agreement for us to look at, an addendum to the regional agreement. Staff provided comments back to them. They quickly incorporated those comments and got those back to us. And they have a form that we believe meets all of our needs. So we're at the point where we would come back to the board, to our board, to you in a future meeting with a resolution to approve that. And with that approved addendum, East Wenatchee Water District would then prepare the amendment to the regional comp plan, which would actually be submitted by the city to the Department of Health for approval, and that would complete everything and update the regional agreement and the regional comp plan with that expanded service territory. That's all I have for you. Are there any questions for me at this time?
Good presentation, Ron.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. So if folks are agreeable, then we'll go ahead and put that resolution together and be back perhaps as early as next week, or excuse me, next board meeting.
Great. Thanks, Ron.
Cool. All right.
All right. Next up, we had kind of a scary moment up in Chelan, and Kirk Hudson's going to talk about that.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Just wanted to let you know we did file a ramp rate deviation report for spill levels in the Chelan Gorge with FERC back on July 22nd, Wednesday, July 22nd. This had to do with actually part of a rescue of six individuals, young men, 18 to 20 years of age, roughly, that had hiked into the gorge and were actually in the water and got themselves to the other side, and then spill levels had gone up as a result of some of the maintenance work we were doing at Chelan Hydro, and then they found themselves in a very difficult spot. Two of them were able to make it back across the river, struggled, while the other four observed that and decided not to cross, thankfully. And what ended up ensuing was Chelan Fire and Rescue, Chelan County Sheriff deputies, and PUD security, as well as some PUD employees, helped to get the river flows down so that the fire and rescue team could get a ladder across that part of the gorge to get all six of them safely to the other side. But the requirement in the gorge and the river for spill levels is that we can only adjust those river levels down no more than 2 inches per hour, and that's just to help prevent any stranding of fish. And so, as you can imagine, in a situation like this, you know, when public safety is involved, we'll do what we need to do and then notify the regulatory agencies. So certainly a good outcome. it's a good reminder for the public in general. The Chelan Gorge can be very dangerous. To honor those warning signs and no trespassing signs there. But I'd like to thank Kirby Reinhardt, Dan Garrison, Stacy Lloyd, Monty Milinek, and our security team who all responded at one point. Dan Garrison, our hydro director, went up there personally and was able to help the rescue team using his own drone. He was able to fly a piece of paper down to the four that were stranded on the other side and just let them know that help was on the way and ask if they were all okay. And they did return that piece of paper saying they were all okay and were waiting and would stand by for the rescuers. So just a great response from our team and our security team. So don't expect there to be much that comes out of the notification of the ramp rate deviation, but just wanted to make you aware of that.
Thanks, Kirk. I followed that on social media, and that was really a pretty scary rescue. So good job.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, Justin Erickson has a couple of items, so starting with a parks update, and then we're going to talk a little bit about air filtration for COVID issues. Justin?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. First update I'm going to provide to you is just talk to you a little bit about what we're seeing at our district recreational sites. So as you might imagine, with COVID and the encouragement to be outside because it's safer. We've seen incredibly high usage throughout our facilities, with especially high use in the Chelan area. So specifically, that means that we've seen really long lines for camping at BB Campground, large crowds at Riverwalk Park and at Powerhouse Park, to a little lesser extent at Chelan Falls, but very busy, and obviously busy here too in terms of Wenatchee and at other sites, but particularly high density in the Chelan area. And so we've had issues with our boat launches and trash and sanitation, and we fielded a number of calls and emails from the general public as well as neighboring property owners expressing concerns. And we've kind of evaluated this challenge. We've talked to our colleagues, and we've seen what's been happening statewide and region-wide, and we are certainly not alone in this. You may have seen some of the recent press releases with regard to what Washington State Parks is doing. They, about a week and a half ago, they announced closures at day-use facilities at Lake Chelan and Lake Wenatchee. When the parking lots are full, and they indicated the limited ability to social distance because of the crowds, particularly at the swim beaches. I thought that was particularly notable because there's 142 state parks, and the Washington State Parks and Recreation Commission specifically adjust the regulations at two of those, both of which, of course, are in Chelan County. So it really highlights that our issue is unique even in the state with our usage. And then last week, the city of Chelan at a city council meeting made a similar decision for Don Morse and Lakeside Park, where they're going to close the day use areas once the parking lots are full, not allow any other individuals to come in. And then over the weekend in the Wenatchee World, there was an article about what the National Forest specifically the Okanagan Wenatchee National Forest is seeing. And I thought a quote in there was particularly relevant, where a recreational coordinator was quoted as saying, "The weekdays are what weekends used to be, and the weekends are more like holidays." And that's certainly been our experience. So, you know, wanting to avoid park and facility closures and knowing that in some cases closures may not be a viable option at all, we've made some operational changes to help address these challenges. So want to just mention a few of those now. So we've reassigned two Parks PUD staff members from Rocky Reach to provide more assistance in the Chelan area. We've added additional security patrols. And we are coordinating closely with county law enforcement, been able to add some county sheriff coverage at our facilities, and then frequent discussions with the city of Chelan and with Washington State Parks. Also added some portable restroom facilities and trash receptacles, and are reviewing signage to make changes where needed and to better emphasize the COVID-19 specific signage relative to the distancing. And we're hopeful that with Labor Day on the horizon, that these actions will allow us to maintain adequate service levels and mitigate the crowds and ensure public safety. But certainly it's been a very challenging year, and I'd like to recognize our parks and security staff and our security contractors for working through these very challenging times. They've remained very professional and calm in stressful situations, challenges interacting with the public, especially at BB Campground. And they've really personified the best of who we are as a district and as public servants. So wanted to give a special recognition to those staff members. Are there any questions before I move on to my next item?
Okay. Justin, are there any folks that are being rude? Are you seeing that kind of thing? And where I'm going with this is you've undoubtedly heard that some folks, when asked about social distancing or masks, have done pushing and shoving and other things. Have we experienced any of that kind of behavior?
We have experienced members of the public that have been very irate. Thankfully, I'm not aware of any physical altercations. But I think it's fair to say that you know, people are stressed, and because of the crowding, and because, quite frankly, I think we're all just, you know, tired of COVID and the impacts to our lives, that tempers are short, and we're certainly experiencing that. And when we had a couple of more heightened situations a couple of weeks ago, that's when we really tried to amplify our security presence and our law enforcement presence, and that has helped. Last weekend was a little quieter, and last week with the super hot temperatures, that actually helped keep the crowds away as well. So hopefully that's consistent with what we'll see for the rest of the season.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to change gears with you now and talk with you about some COVID mitigation strategies that we've been evaluating and implementing specific to our facilities at the district and our HVAC systems. So we've spent considerable time and resources evaluating potential changes and improvements to our HVAC systems. And this has been increasingly important to us because of the evidence. Heightened evidence about airborne transmission as a major source of COVID-19 spread. And so some of the early actions that we took earlier on in this pandemic were to increase the percentage of outside air into the system. And that was actually an early recommendation from the CDC. Shortly thereafter, we started a process to evaluate what it would take to upgrade the air filters to at least a MERV 13 standard, which is, we are seeing a lot more literature out there about the importance of doing just that and the effectiveness of MERV 13 in at least reducing significant amounts of viruses in general, let alone COVID. And so we have begun the process of upgrading our units where technically feasible. and where concentrations of people occur. So we have a number of facilities, and it likely does not make sense to upgrade all of them, but where we have congregations of people and people that are in the building for a long period of time is where we've really focused our efforts, at least to date. And thankfully, it's a relatively modest cost to make these upgrades and a modest increase in operation and maintenance expenses. So the filters are, there's a little bit of modification to be able to accommodate the larger filter or the thicker filter. And then the filters are a little bit more expensive and are changed on a little bit greater frequency. But overall, it's in the tens of thousands of dollars, not in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to make these improvements. So we've started that in earnest, have got the Fifth Street campus nearly complete, along, and are now rotating to other facilities around the district. And when we look at, of course, we're at an interesting time with all of the facilities work. And so we've also said for our new facilities and those activities where we have major rehabilitation going on, that we're going to look at similar improvements. So that includes the Service Center, Rock Island and Rocky Reach facilities, that would be the main office buildings at each of those sites. And then we've got some design work currently underway to replace HVAC systems at our powerhouses. And so we are working with our mechanical engineers and contractors to integrate best technology to help further mitigate, knowing that hopefully, even though COVID hopefully will be a bit of a remnant in a year or two, we know that these improvements just make sense for general air quality enhancements, as well as other viruses and illnesses. And then, in addition to that, we've taken a look at other technologies, things like UV or UVC disinfection, HEPA filtration, and bipolar ionization. And bipolar ionization in particular is one that seems to hold a lot of promise. And it utilizes charged ions to kill viruses directly, and also it improves the ability for those viruses to be captured in the filter. And so we've got an effort underway currently to install our first bipolar ionization equipment into the service building here at the Fifth Street campus, and hope to complete that work later in the month. And our hope with successful deployment there, we hope to quickly follow that up with an installation at headquarters and perhaps elsewhere in the district. And then we have integrated this technology into the Service Center planning, as well as our Rock Island and Rocky Reach facility planning efforts. Mm-hmm. So lots of activity related to COVID mitigation and our HVAC systems. I probably threw some terms out there that you may not be familiar with, but are there any questions or any information I can provide you?
Is it good?
Okay, you can get a sense from Justin's presentation that we are moving forward with some of these actions, and that there are some costs incurred, but given the risks that are out there, it seems like the right action to take. And particularly with our new buildings, there's an opportunity here to be able to take an action at a time when it would be less costly than trying to accomplish a retrofit. With that, I'm going to invite Lisa Sanders to come up, and we're ready to talk about something that probably there's not very much of these days, commission travel. While she's coming up, I'm just going to quickly mention that we did reopen Gerald's today, takeout only for any of you who are coming and are in the building. I just wanted you to know that Gerald's has been closed for the last few months, but as of today, they're open. Lisa?
Good afternoon. I don't have a lot to report. We did have the APPA fall board meeting cancel in-person meeting. So, Randy, Commissioner Smith, we did get your hotel canceled.
Good. Good. Thank you. Also, I don't know if you're aware, but Wapuda has gone to the rest of the year. It will be completely by Zoom.
Okay. So that was my question today, if I should cancel those Olympia rooms. So I will do that.
And I believe that will extend. The January meeting may be by Zoom also, but let's hold off on that for the moment.
Okay. So I don't have anything else unless you have something for me or need to be registered for something.
Commissioners, are there any meetings or conventions or travel that is coming up that we're aware of between now and the end of the year that Lisa may need to be made aware of? I think that most all agencies and associations have moved to virtual meetings for the remainder of the year. That's what I'm seeing in my world.
Yeah, I believe so, too.
Yeah.
Okay, I remain available. If there's anything at all I can help you with, just let me know.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Lisa.
You're welcome.
So that accomplishes our manager's item, and I did jump ahead to commission travel just because I saw Lisa in the room, so I thought we'd get that taken care of. So, commissioners, back to you for commission items.
So, commissioners, do we have any commissioner items to share?
I just want to let people be aware that regarding the executive session this afternoon, I have a video doctor's appointment at 3, so I will be able to attend until then.
We would expect to be done by then.
Perfect. Thank you, Steve.
Well, if there are no commission items, we can move on to delegation items, Steve.
Okay, let me just do one quick one for commissioners. I think I had mentioned previously, I hope I had, that we have installed automatic temperature takers in a number of the buildings around the district. We have one here at headquarters. We've done this as a pilot program. It's been working very well. We get a lot of positive feedback about it. I would encourage you to try it out if you come into the building. I think there is a reasonable chance, given how well it's worked, that at some point this will probably become a mandatory program. And so it'd be good for you to give it a try and see if you have any issues with it. I don't know what the name of the door is. It's the, help me, Rebecca or Eric, where the?
I think, right, it's the delivery door down by the commissioner's parking to the main headquarters there,
yeah.
Just to the south of the Gerald's entrance.
So if you walk in that door, you can't miss it. It's about 10 steps inside the door there. In terms of delegation of action items, we just had one from the last meeting. Rebecca was going to remove the tracking of constituent communication from the board balance scorecard. That has been completed. We have also completed a couple things that were from previous meetings. Eric sent out his issue of paper regarding tariff impacts on contracts was completed on July 20th. And then we had a follow-up item to connect Catherine Willard with Commissioner Congdon and understand on the Skaha hatchery issue, and I understand that has taken place. And so those are the only two that I have. Any questions about those? Okay, and hearing none, I just have one action item from this meeting, and that's a follow-up with respect to Commissioner Arsenault's questions about local improvement district bonds. as a funding option for infrastructure cost recovery, and I think we'll probably be sharing that one between Lindsay and Eric, with actually Eric taking the lead on this one.
Thank you.
And that's it. Did you miss anything?
I don't think so. All right. Commissioners, are there any other comments or any other information to be shared? Well, hearing none, at this time I would like to open up phone lines for members of the public that might be on the line. They're encouraged to make comment and ask questions. But if you do wish to make a comment, please state your name and address for the record, and be kind enough to please limit your comments to 3 minutes. So phone lines will be open at this time. Hearing no comments, we should, at this time, Steve, is this appropriate to move into executive session?
Yes, it would be.
All right. So we will be moving into executive session, and we'll be there for roughly how long, 15 minutes, Steve?
We'll call it 20.
All right. For 20 minutes, we will be in executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement action, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCW. All right. We're coming out of executive session. It is August 3rd, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.